Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Revision Energy. Sunbug Solar is now part of Revision Energy, a solar installer committed to being a renewable energy partner for New England and working to fight climate change. Learn more at sunbugsolar.com.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, the first wave of the coronavirus has turned into a tsunami. Now, some states across the country are grappling with a nightmarish increase in case counts that's forced the governors of California, Florida, and Texas to walk back some of the reopening plans. Even in a state like ours that's trending in the right direction, the virus is still present. And since we're in phase two, what should we be prepared for? In a few minutes, we'll ask Dr. Catherine Gergen-Barnett when she's here to answer our questions and yours.
In the wake of George Floyd's murder, corporate America spoke up and said Black Lives Matter. But are they truly willing to put their money where their mouth is? Despite diversity problems in the upper echelons of some of America's most powerful corporations, in recent weeks, several companies have committed to righting the wrongs of racial injustice. We'll learn more about this from Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Young up ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there. You surprised by the Supreme Court decision?
I am a little bit surprised because I didn't know what John Roberts is going to do about this.
Of course.
He's normally much more conservative about this. He didn't really vote on the issues about this being an unnecessary claim about caring about women's health. I mean, that's ridiculous because the longer you wait to get an abortion, the more perilous your health becomes. And this is what it would do, is hold up women and make it longer before they could get abortions. But he did say that the case needed to be treated the same as the Texas case, which was also bogusly claiming that they were concerned about women's health. I don't believe that for a second.
You know, we should. I just want to say one more minute on this before we get to the topic at hand. You know, the argument was in this case and in the Texas thing, they're requiring that doctors who perform abortions have admitting privileges at a hospital, was, as you suggest, for important for the health of the woman in case there's a problem with the abortion. Can I read you one? This is in the New York Times from the lower court judges. I can't pronounce his name. The federal district court judge in Baton Rouge who struck down the law in 2017, listen to this. In the last 23 years, Hope Clinic, this is in Shreveport, yeah, which serves in excess of 3,000 patients per year, had only four patients who required transfer to a hospital for treatment. In each instance, regardless of whether the physician had admitting privileges, the patient received appropriate care. So there's not only, there's no, beyond the precedent, there's no factual basis.
None.
For the law, which obviously was a backdoor attempt to make abortion virtually impossible, would have left with one abortion doctor in the state of Louisiana. So good for Roberts, which also, I get once again, the plus of this is I think it puts center stage something you and I have been talking about for our 20 years on the air. One of the most important decisions you make every 4 years in November is who's going to pick Supreme Court justices who serve for life. In any case, that's that. On Friday, it was Friday, during the White House Coronavirus Task Force briefing, Vice President Pence did his best to put a positive spin on how the U.S. is managing the outbreak.
We have made truly remarkable progress in moving our nation forward. We've all seen the encouraging news as we open up America again. More than 3 million jobs created in the last job report. Retail sales are rolling. And, of course, the extraordinary progress in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and New Orleans, areas that just a matter of a month ago were struggling under the weight of this pandemic.
Now, unfortunately, we are still struggling under the weight of this pandemic. The United States has surpassed, as you probably know, 2.5 million confirmed cases as a new wave of infections churns through the South and West, making Texas, Arizona, and Florida the nation's new epicenters of coronavirus. Given the nature of this infectious disease, though, what does this resurgence in the South mean for New England? Joining us in line for our take on this is Dr. Catherine Gergen-Barnett. She's the Vice Chair of Primary Care Innovation and Transformation and Residency Director in the Department of Family Medicine at Boston Medical Center and BU Medical School. She will also take any of your questions on COVID-19 and your calls. Catherine Gergen-Barnett, good to talk to you again. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us. So let's start with where we are in the United States. What kind of shape are we in?
So, you know, it's always interesting to hear briefings where there's so much reassurance given. I think the beginning of the reassurance that Pence gave was very much about the financial uptick with reopening. But as you mentioned earlier in the beginning of the hour on your show, we know that 30 states around the country right now are seeing a massive uptick in the number of cases. And as Jim also just mentioned, Texas, Florida, and Arizona are in pretty deep water right now, not only with the number rising of cases, but the acuity of the cases and the number of ICU beds that are being occupied. So while we have seen very reassuring numbers in Massachusetts as of late, which we are very grateful for, and there's more to discuss about that for sure, I would say that if you look at a map of the United States, the majority of the states are sort of going towards red, which means there's increased number of cases and not a decrease, unfortunately.
You know, I'm not 100% sure this is his exact line, speaking of Massachusetts, but I believe whenever Governor Baker, doctor, is asked at a press conference about what do we do if, should we bar someone from Florida, Texas, or Arizona from coming into the state, I think he raises what he considers to be a constitutional concern. But regardless of what his argument is, what do we do? I mean, we are trending in the right direction here for the most part. The only two states where the actual numbers are going down, we learned over the weekend, are Connecticut and Rhode Island. But things are trending in the right direction here. This is a place that a lot of people like to come, like New York. What do we do when people want to come from the Texases and the Arizonas and the Floridas? What do we do about that?
I think you're asking exactly the right question. I was actually just asking this question of my friend yesterday, who works at the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. And you know, New York and Connecticut have put quarantine measures on people coming from out of state. And I actually, as a physician and somebody very concerned about public health, I you know, would very much encourage us to look at Massachusetts, to look at a similar model. I'm very well aware that many places in Massachusetts, including places like Cape Cod, depend on visitors from out of state for financial security in years to come. But I think many of us feel very protective of the work that we've done to date to get our numbers so low. And I will tell you, you know, it's come April 20th of this past year when we were really at the height. We didn't know when and if and how we'd get to this such a good place as we are right now. And I think that we all need to be thinking long and hard about who we encourage to come into town, so thinking about family members or others, and B, how we can be working with the state and policymakers about ways that we can protect our state. If we're not going to mandate quarantine, then what can we do? Can we insist that somebody's had a negative test, 24 to 48 hours before entry? And what are other ways that we can protect our borders? Because unfortunately, as we all know, or many of us kind of believe, and I'm a firm believer, that what we really need is a national response, obviously, and it's because we're 50 states and most of the states are contiguous and the borders are obviously very porous. But without that, every state is having to make their own decisions. And New England, a lot of New England states have made a decision together to quarantine visitors, but Massachusetts is not. So I think we need to think long and hard about that.
You know, Jim teased me about giving the annual, the daily South Boston update report on mask wearing, and I just happened to have been there on Friday, full of young people. We now know that young people are thought in these outbreaks in the South and West to going to bars and stuff. They were outside, but it was, I would say, maybe 15% of people that I saw were wearing masks. On the beach, maybe it's not such a big deal. But
1-5 or 5-0? Yeah. 1-5.
1-5.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Walking all along the boardwalk there, almost nobody. And I thought, wow, should cops come by and say, put on a mask, or should somebody be paying? I mean, you feel like you have to walk out in the middle of the street 15 feet away from somebody who's walking. You know, and I have to restrain myself from being like Mother Superior and giving somebody a speech of where the heck is your mask. But you know what I mean? It's not everybody's with the program.
Look, I mean, I think that people, lots of people have grown very weary. We continue to see very positive statistics coming out of Massachusetts. I think it's allowed many people to sort of have their guard down. With summer weather, people also feel like just, you know, wanting more freedom. And I think that, you know, I think Baker's done a good job of continuing to communicate, you know, you need to wear your mask, you need to socially distance. And for the most part, I actually think Massachusetts citizens have been doing a fabulous job on that. I will also say, though, that young people have gotten a lot of messages of they can't get sick. Right. I mean, I think the asymptomatic spread among young people is pretty new data. Not everybody may be reading the newspaper or thinking about it. And so people think they're immune. And then they also think, oh, well, I'm outside. You know, the problem is not only are they putting themselves at risk with asymptomatic spread and everybody else, and I also hate to sound like Mother Superior, but I worry about some of these habits and how they're going to transform the landscape of the positive uptick once we come back indoors. Because you know, the cat is a little bit out of the bag, perhaps. And it's going to be hard, really hard to go back for people.
I want to get back to masks later because there are so many issues around it. But I just have one more thing before we get to the calls, and then we have a few more things for you, too. We're only, I guess, is this almost July? Yes. 2 months away from school reopening, and I say that in quotes, whatever that means. Jeff Riley, the education commissioner, talked about these multiple scenarios. If things don't change dramatically from where they currently are, and I know that's a big if, but just that's all we have is where we currently are.
Sure.
In Massachusetts, for example, or New Hampshire and Rhode Island, where things are going relatively well, and they're listening today, too. What do you say to a parent who's worried about sending his or her 12-year-old back to a classroom, an indoor classroom, come late August or early September, Doctor?
Yeah, look, you know, I'm also the mother of three children, so I think about this a lot.
How old are your kids?
I have a 16-year-old, a 12-year-old, and a 7-year-old.
Oh, perfect.
So
okay.
Every
great
domain.
Great. Okay.
So you know, as a professional, as personal, I think, you know, first of all, obviously, we'll be tracking the numbers very carefully. I think the released kind of suggestions from last week, I thought, were really well thought out. I am concerned about this question of how far apart the desks are. So there's a question of 3 feet apart or 6 feet apart, you know, and everybody over second grade and up needing to wear a mask. You know, I can only imagine that kids, if they're 3 feet apart, you know, it's very hard to imagine somebody in second grade wanting to keep their mask on all day.
Right.
And so that's pretty close. So I worry about that. But I also, on the flip side of it, is we need to be thinking about the mental health consequences and the educational consequences of our kids not going back to some sort of hybrid learning. And, you know, the disparity, again, we've seen disparity in every single domain around coronavirus and, frankly, around, you know, health care delivery in our country. And those who have access to good computers or ability to do distance learning and those who don't and those who are in homes where They may be suffering at the hands of an abuser even more being at home, or having greater anxiety or depression or trauma and not having access to a therapist or good meals or, you know, all the things that we know that schools can provide for families. I think that's the flip side. So I think we need to be carefully thinking about both the public health part and the medical part. And if we're at where we are now, you know, I feel confident that schools can do things in a semi-safe way.
We're talking to Dr. Catherine Gergen-Barnett, Vice Chair of Primary Care Innovation Transformation at BU and Boston Medical Center. Let's go to Kate in Concord. Thank you for your calling, Kate.
Hi, Kate.
Hi, thank you so much. Sure. I'm a 67-year-old. Can you hear me?
Sure.
Yeah. I'm a 67-year-old, reasonably healthy mom, type A blood. I haven't seen my 28-year-old daughter who lives in Chicago since February. She's planning on coming home to split her time between her dad and me in a week. She did go to Vancouver and Seattle right when the COVID spike started, and she's been tested positive for antibodies out there in Chicago. So should I house her and her four-month-old golden retriever for a week?
Oh, Kate, that's such a good question. And I know, you know, among the listeners that you're certainly not alone. So the antibody testing is interesting. I think it's wonderful she was able to get it. And I think that we don't know for certain what that means in terms of whether she is likely to have had it in the past and how likely is she to get it again. I am very pleased that you're healthy and you're 67. And, you know, if she had more time, I might suggest that she kind of quarantines for 2 weeks before seeing you. It sounds like that's not possible. And my only hope is that maybe you could do a little bit of mitigation of risk where she could be in a separate quarters from you. You could be eating out of totally separate kind of pots where you're making your meals and eating far enough apart that you're not spreading germs and being hypervigilant if she is to come visit you. You know, but generally I think if people have a chance again in terms of traveling that they're actually having some time to kind of self-quarantine, even up from 5 to 14 days before they see a loved one. But it sounds like if you can make some sort of mitigation strategy, I'm hopeful you'll be able to see her in a safe way.
Okay, good luck. You know, you mentioned air travel a second ago, Doctor. I'm sure you read over the weekend American Airlines is, I don't know what the date is, I think it may be July 1st, is no longer an empty seat between passengers. Yeah. They're going to fill it up. You may request, if they have one, an alternative flight to your destination. And again, if it's available, they'll give it to you. Is there any defense other than the bottom line for that decision by the airline?
No.
Well, that's quick enough. Okay.
But, you know, I'm not going to say that they don't have to defend their bottom line, but there's nothing that's thinking about the safety of passengers in putting that back, that middle seat. Any of us who've done any airlines travel over the last 10 years knows there's about 2 inches between our faces when we're on those. You know, in those middle seats. And, you know, that's the same. I worry about that with the MBTA and many other things where people have to think about sort of getting back to service and bottom line and saying, oh, well, we just can't control how many people are on and how close they are. But I'm very hopeful that people will be able to find, or less people will be flying and hopefully less people booking in the middle seat. But no, I don't think there's any public health way to defend that decision.
Here's a question from Joel from Newton via email. He says, given that we have so many colleges and universities in Boston, many opening up in August and September, how worried should we be about students from southern and western states coming back to Boston?
Joel, I think that's a great question. And again, I'm hopeful that colleges will be able to make some sort of decisions around this. Again, if the state is not making mandated quarantine. But I might suggest that colleges have people who are coming from out of state come a week early and quarantine before going into dorms, and, you know, having kind of a negative test as well before they're going into dorms. But, you know, even though that feels right around the corner, I think we still have about 4 to 6 weeks to make some of those policies, but I think colleges need to be thinking now about what they're requesting from the hot spots and where people are coming from.
You know, before we get back to the phones, Doctor, the caller, and by the way, our number is 877-301-8970. The lines are full, but when somebody hangs up, feel free. You mentioned when we were talking about American Airlines, you know, there's the T as well. So what do you say to somebody who has no choice but to ride the T to get to work? And we've heard the head of the T say there will not be a capacity limit as such.
Yeah.
But they've restored the full service, so hopefully with fewer people riding it, you know, that's. But what do you say to someone who says, I don't want to do it, but I have no choice? How do I minimize the safety risks?
Yeah, I was actually just talking to a patient of mine about this the other day as well. So he uses the T at extremely off hours. So, you know, if there's an opportunity to use it when you know that there, you can kind of self-regulate the number of people who are going to be in the T, that is definitely the preferable thing to do. And obviously kind of sanitizing your hands before and after the T and wearing a mask and just, you know, keeping yourself kind of as safe as you can while you're in the T. And I know that, you know, the MBTA is also doing the best that they can to make sure that they keep their trains and their buses clean and do kind of regular sanitization of those areas. So I know that they are also working hard on their end, but I think probably shifting hours if possible.
Let's go to Heidi in Newburyport. You're on with Dr. Catherine Gergen-Burnett. Hi, Heidi.
Hey, how are you guys?
Great.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a little report, Marjorie, like you from the north there, like with masks. It's driving me absolutely crazy because we live on the border. And we have so many people who come from different places. And at first, when we first started to open up, there was a lot of compliance. Now it's like out of the window. You go to the beaches, people are all over each other. I counted like 11 kids just like piling on top of each other, whatever. And then downtown and around town, it's not being required. And if you go to the supermarket, it's like the mask burlesque show. People put them up, they put them down, they put them halfway across their nose. Like, that's
my
question to you.
What do you do?
My question to you, doctor.
Yeah,
no, my question, because I
what
can't
is your
anything, but so my exact question is, at what point does the governor say, okay, guys, you know, I've made this suggestion, but we're seeing our numbers ticking up. Is there a point where he says, okay, your ticket to ride, to be able to have our economy functioning, you have to wear a mask in public, full stop, unless you're eating or drinking. That's it. I don't understand how this is a problem, because people, he leaves that leeway, like, unless you can social distance. Well, I'm seeing people not socially distancing, and I'm afraid our little neck of the woods is going to blow up.
So your question is, should we have a statewide mandate?
Well, and at what point do we go from suggestion to requirement? Is there a rubric from the medical community that says, okay, you've tipped too far?
How about it, doctor?
Yeah, thank you, Heidi. You know, there actually is a mandate. You know, in Massachusetts, unlike you know, what we're hearing nationally, we are being asked to wear a mask. So I think, you know,
We should be clear, doctor.
Asked
and urged, but not required.
Correct. Okay.
Okay.
So that is correct. And to Heidi's point, there's nobody going around ticketing people or fining people. And again, I think because our numbers are so much in the positive directions, it can keep that sense of complacency at bay. I would hate to have it be a massive spike in cases that gets it up again. I will say that, unfortunately, you know, we can talk to our families, we can talk to our kids, we can talk to our community members, we can make sure that we're wearing our masks. And I would love for there to be a very clarifying mandate on it. And again, I think there is this gentle dance between what are people expecting in terms of their own rights as citizens and where, you know, how they feel infringed upon versus how much can we absolutely mandate for a public health perspective. And that's just, you know, I think what every state, unfortunately, is having to make those their own decisions on that, again, because there's not a national mandate on this. And, you know, Pence, for the first time, wore a mask on Sunday and talked about the importance of wearing masks. And obviously that was a shot at a left field as a national response. So Heidi, I wish I had a better answer for you. I can tell you, as a physician, as somebody who deeply cares about public health, I urge you and everyone you love to be continuing to wear masks, and as much as we can, just continue the public education piece. And I would say testing. So our testing has gone down in Massachusetts, mostly because it's driven by people who want to get tested, and less people are getting tested because the numbers are down and because the cases are down. But we know that asymptomatic spread is a real thing, as we talked about earlier in the show. And so the North End, the, you know, South Boston areas, there's a lot of young people who could be spreading it asymptomatically. So how do we do what hotspots like Florida are doing now, where they're just saying, we're going to go into young communities and just test people and not make it driven by people coming to us, but actually go out into the community and start testing?
Well, we actually, we had two
part of what we need to do.
To the state's credit, a week ago, Wednesday and Thursday, we did those pop-up. And thank you, Hardy.
Yeah.
We did those pop-up things for protesters. Like Marjorie actually had a test, even though she couldn't figure out what her results were. So
I do not at the moment have the virus.
You know, can I? I don't know.
You could be tested on Monday and have it on Tuesday. So, you know, I hope I don't have
Doctor, before we take a brief break, I am obsessed with Pence's sycophantic behavior in this mask thing. And while you are right that when he went to the church in Dallas, he wore a mask till he got up. I the only amendment I want to make to your comment there is he chose to go to a church where there were 2,400 people in a church that seats 3,000. He chose to go to a church where 100 beautiful chorus singers
took
off their masks and are singing at the top of their lungs. And we have all learned how singing and shouting is super spreader to the extreme. There was that choir chorus you remember in Washington State. What, 52 people ended up testing
that
positive, and two people died. So
you are
right that for once, because he was 2,000 miles away from the man he's scared of, the president of the United States, he had the courage to wear a mask for a brief period of time. He still shouldn't have been there. I mean, I know that's not your
thing. I could not agree with you more.
Okay,
and the choir thing made me so sad and upset. You know, they all put their choir members all put their masks right back on after they were done singing. But obviously that doesn't help. I think there's, again, it's all the mixed messages. And now we wonder why young people just go, you know, they just want to go off.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Whatever they want to do. There's no clear messages.
We got to take
we're
a break.
We're talking to Dr. Catherine Gergen-Barnett about all things coronavirus. She's with Boston Medical Center and BU's Medical School. The conversation continues after this brief break on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And if you just tuned in for this whole hour, we are joined by Dr. Catherine Gergen-Barnett. She's the Vice Chair of Primary Care, Innovation and Transformation, and Residency Director in the Department of Family Medicine at Boston Medical Center and BU Medical School. She's taking our questions and your calls to the noon hour at 877-301-8970.
Doctor, we have a bunch of questions about similar things. Number one, do we know what it means to be asymptomatic, besides that you don't have symptoms. I mean, does this mean you may get symptoms later, or we just don't know? And I'll follow up with a question about antibodies, but what's the asymptomatic deal?
Yeah, so, I mean, asymptomatic, you know, means very literally without symptoms. But what we're seeing from a lot of the data is that this asymptomatic is not, it is kind of pre-symptoms for some people.
Okay.
So the initial kind of cases that came out were somebody got sick when a colleague was visiting from China, and the colleague left and 2 days later started feeling quite sick.
Okay.
So we know that the spread of virus happens then. And then the other thing that can happen is that we're considered asymptomatic if, you know, say you have a tickle in your throat or maybe you're a little bit more tired, and you never would have attributed those symptoms to having COVID. So people would say, mm-hmm. I never even had any symptoms. So it's kind of a broad category or term that's used either for before symptoms start or that you have very light symptoms.
Okay, and the second related question to that is, what does it mean to have antibodies, and should people even bother getting the test since you're reading whether, we read whether, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40% of the time they're
50.
Inaccurate tests?
50.
Is it 50 now?
Yeah. Some.
Yeah, you know, I think the jury's really still out on this of what it means. You know, the good news is for the initial data on having antibodies, positive antibodies, meaning you've gotten it, you know, you've been exposed and you have antibodies, is that we're seeing that those people are not likely to get symptoms again, and that's what is very hopeful, again, about the vaccine, because you want to make sure that we can develop antibodies for a vaccine to work. That's the whole premise of a vaccine. So we're seeing positive signs about getting antibody testing, and it meaning that you will likely not get COVID again, or if you get it, you'll get very mild symptoms and shorter duration. But we don't quite have enough data on exactly what that means. So if you have access to it, and I know a lot of colleagues who are in healthcare who are wondering about it for their own sake or their family's sake or just work sake are getting these tests, then I wouldn't dissuade people from getting it, but I also wouldn't, you know, put your entire hinge everything on having a positive or negative antibody test.
Before we get back to the calls very quickly, are you in the Fauci school of vaccine prognostication, meaning he's cautiously optimistic by the beginning of 2021?
Yeah,
there's a vaccine.
You know, I'm cautiously optimistic by nature, and I think Fauci has really been sort of steadfast in his pursuit of all the data that's come out, and similarly, when I look at what has come out, I'm hopeful that you know, initially we heard 4 to 5 years, which yeah. sort of is jaw dropping, but that they're making very good progress on it, and it seems that potentially in the beginning of 2021. We may be to some, you know, not maybe not a final solution, but at least an initial set of vaccines. That's fingers crossed.
Let's go to Michael from Westford. You're on Boston Public Radio with Dr. Catherine Gergen-Barnett. Hey there, Michael.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
We can.
Yes.
Oh, great, great. So, first of all, first time, long time.
Thanks.
You guys are great.
Thanks.
Thank you, Doctor.
I'm 63 years old, and I work. Right now I'm in a barn throwing hay bales down. However, the softball league that I belong to is going to start operating in about a week, and I'm wondering, should I take the risk? We're supposed to wear our masks when we're swinging the bat, maintain social distancing, but I'm not sure about, you know, now that we're beginning to reopen, will we experience a surge, and am I just risking too much?
Thank you so much for your call, Michael, and terrific that you're in such great shape for throwing down hay bales. So that's great, you know, from a cardiac perspective, I can tell you're very healthy. But I will say, you know, I think throwing a ball, so wearing masks is great, but you're, unless all of your softball teammates are, you know, wearing gloves, and I'm just trying to think about how the ball works. And I think you have a right to be a little speculative about, you know, your chances of being exposed. And you know, unless they have more guidelines than just a mask, and thinking really about how you're actually kind of keeping the ball antiseptic in between and other kind of safety measures, I might think about sitting out this season. And again, very hopeful, as we just discussed, that we might be closer to a vaccine and we'll know a lot more by next softball season. I would get more data before you say yes.
Michael, why don't you just invite some of your teammates over and throw some hay bales or whatever the hell they are that you're throwing around the barn?
That's a better workout than softball.
What's up, Michael?
We'll be huffing and puffing.
I bet you will. Sound pretty good.
I do know that they're supposed to, pardon me.
Go ahead.
I do want to say they are planning on wiping down the equipment in between. I don't know how often, like between each pitch. I don't know if that'll happen, but there are provisions for that. But anyway, my instinct is not to do it, you know. I hate it.
I think you should go with your instinct, Michael.
Thank you,
Michael,
for the
good
call.
Luck. Thank you very much for your
here's
call.
Here's an interesting question from Judy. She wants to know if it's unethical if you are asymptomatic and not an essential worker to get a test. Is she putting a strain on the healthcare system if she just wants to get a test for her social life?
Thanks, Judy. No, you are not. I mean, our healthcare system is here to protect people and give access to people who need a test or want a test. It is not as easy to get a test in Massachusetts as it is in other states, I will tell you. Secondhand experience. And Marjorie, I heard that, you know, that you went and got tested after protests. And I know that that was a big opportunity for some people. I think that if people have an option to get a test, they should get tested. We are not hitting where we need to for testing. And we have a lot more capacity to test than we are.
You know, Doctor, I'm sorry.
I just wondered why people are not. Are they having difficulty? Are they being refused the tests? Or are they just not calling up to say?
I think probably some of the initial data that came out showing how difficult it was and how slow we were to get tests online probably scared some people off. And I think some people are like the last, you know, person who called in who said, look, you know, I feel bad. Like, it's similar to this idea of, you know, what we initially had around masks, right? Like where we told people, oh, don't wear a mask, just keep masks for healthcare workers. But now we're saying, no, really, everybody should wear a mask. And similarly, we really think that everyone should be taking care of their health. And if they are able to get a test, you know, whether it be through a local clinic or a CVS or a drive-through, then please get it.
You know, before we go ahead, last week I had on television, I had Ayanna Pressley with me, who I guess about a month ago had questioned the reopening timetable of the governor, saying it was too soon, particularly for vulnerable communities, people of color, low-income people. And obviously you work at Boston Medical Center, the wonderful institution that serves mostly vulnerable people. She said she still had some concerns as recently as last week. What has the impact of the multi-phase Baker plan been on the community that you serve, Doctor?
Yeah, I agree with Ayanna Pressley. I think that in the reopening plan, I think that Baker's had really good people at the table, but I don't think there have been enough people from the community and people of color, people who are sort of in the front line positions, such as, you know, kind of essential workers, that have been able to inform this reopening policy as much as needs to be. I think there's still not enough protections for certain people who are going to essential jobs. You know, they may be, their employers may say, oh, yeah, we know we have protection for you, but they may not actually have enough protection. People are afraid to be taking time from work if they get sick, even though they are meant to get that covered. Not everybody does. So I think that the reopening plan is really thoughtful. But I still think there needs to be more diverse voices shaping it and informing it. And, you know, there was a, there's now a COVID health equity group that came out with a set of policies and recommendations on Juneteenth that looked at, you know, really important data and other things that need to come out around the health equity piece and working with community-based organizations. But it doesn't, as far as I could see, it doesn't fully address the reopening plan and what needs to be done to protect workers in the reopening.
Let's go to Margaret in Framingham. You're on with Dr. Catherine Gergen-Barnett. Hi, Margaret.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I'm sorry. It's Marcus from Framingham.
Marcus,
oh,
I'm
sorry.
So sorry.
Sorry,
my
sorry.
Fault. Hello.
That's okay. That's okay. Just have a quick question. So my father-in-law, who's he's about in like, close to his 70s, he's been experiencing a fever for the past 3-4 days, and just trying to figure out how do we provide care for him. He's now taking Tylenol, but you know, when we go check in on him, he lives by himself. Do we just leave provisions outside? Do we go in with a mask, check in on him, check in on his environment? How do we provide this care to someone who's elderly, lives by himself, but obviously needs a little bit of help during this time?
Marcus, thank you so much for calling, and that sounds very stressful. I just want to try and understand if your father-in-law, whether anybody's gotten in touch with his primary care physician and the primary care physician knows about this, and whether you all could actually go take him to get tested so that you have the data you need. Because, you know, sometimes older people are sick and it's not COVID, so we need to kind of further understand what it is that's going on with your father-in-law so you can best take care of him.
Has there been contact, Marcus, with a primary care physician?
Yes. So my understanding is we're literally just waiting for the results. He contacted his doctor. You know, we're just waiting on the result. And in the meantime, I'm thinking, well, okay. And finally, he's taking Tylenol, and the fever is breaking. So, you know, it all sounds like it's moving towards the right direction. But I'm thinking, somebody needs to physically go into his house, you know, make sure that he has, you know, food, provisions, that the house is clean and clear, and that he is in an environment for healing.
Yeah, of course. So it sounds like you're waiting on the results, and I'm so pleased that he got tested. I think, you know, the good news is about where we are right now as a state that when somebody, as soon as we get the results, it really becomes a public health. If he is positive, it really becomes a public health response. And the primary care provider will also be checking in on him frequently, and there's a whole kind of protocol about doing that in order to, you know, make sure that he is safe and stable and is not getting worse. Obviously, it is wonderful that you're bringing him food. I think I would definitely not recommend going inside of the house, if at all possible. But if you need to, you know, obviously gloved and masked and just sort of bring it right to the front of the door and not entering. And then that being said, you know, for anybody whose loved one gets tested positive, we all need to get tested. So your father-in-law, if he is positive, The Department of Public Health will do something called contact tracing. So everybody who your father-in-law has been in touch with, including, I'm assuming, yourself, will be asked to be tested. So he's very lucky to have you, and I'm going to just, you know, continue to be thinking about you guys.
Marcus, good luck with you and
Thank
your
you.
Father-in-law.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, you mentioned contact tracing. Dr. Paul Farmer has been with us a couple of times. Most recently, maybe a month ago, and obviously Partners in Health is coordinating with the state the contact trace. Do you have any idea how that's going? Because you read reports somewhere around the country that it is wildly unsuccessful. Dr. Farmer sounded pretty positive about the early days here. Do you know?
Look, I mean, if anyone's going to do a good job, Partners in Health would be among the top folks to do it, and was really happy to see that they have done it. And I know a lot of young people signed up to do that work as well. I think we need to think really clearly about trust and distrust in communities when we're thinking about contact tracing. So there are a lot of people who will absolutely not want to give names of loved ones out for a very good reason, you know, whether it has to do with immigration status or, you know, fear of government or just, you know, fear of medical kind of communities. And so I know that there has been I actually read in the New York Times about Massachusetts that a number of positive cases, when they went to go do contact tracing, people didn't answer their phones. And so I think it's probably a mixed bag. And again, this is about health equity and social justice and how we really think about making sure that we're continuing to build communities of trust. So, you know, can there be leaders in communities that are from the community, of the community, that are saying, hey, this is really important, let's all get together and give names. It's safe and it's the right thing to do. And I think there just needs to be some of that undergirding as well.
You know, we're speaking with Dr. Catherine Gergen Barnett. Several people have emailed and say that they are having trouble getting tests. Either they're told they don't have any symptoms, that they don't meet the criteria, which we heard a lot at the beginning. Someone else is nervous and wants to get tested every week, rather. What are we supposed to do about? Because you could get tested on Monday, as you know, and then be negative and then be positive on Tuesday, right?
Right. That's true. I can understand the person who wants to get tested every week may not be able to get that. I'm very hopeful. Look, again, like I said earlier in the show, the asymptomatic spread is it's new and old. There were some people, as we are now reading and knowing and understanding, scientists, amazing scientists, who knew about asymptomatic spread but were sort of shut down, saying their data wasn't good. And now we're knowing that that is actually a real thing. So I'm very hopeful that that will continue to drive up the number of tests that people can get. Again, we come back to the protests, and I think it was a fabulous thing that Baker, you know, opened up these pop-up test sites for those 2 days for anybody who went and protested. And that was, again, for asymptomatic people. I'm hopeful that the recent data will drive access to increased tests. I think anybody who wants to get a test should get in touch with their primary care physician first. And their health insurance also has ideas about where they can go. And there's stuff online where you can find out where there are places near you who are offering tests. And some people may not need to pay out of pocket. So that's, I know, not ideal, but the reality of where we are right now.
You know, Dan just emailed, said his wife is coming home from Florida after 3 months. He is high risk. He says, what's a husband to do? Should she get tested when she gets here? Probably she should get tested before she gets here. I don't know, Dan. But ask what does the doctor think?
Well, so yes, before and after. So, you know, again, it's we come back to this question of what should Massachusetts do, right? Should really be letting an entire you know, huge plane full of 300 people coming from from Florida flying into Massachusetts. So that's question number one. But on a personal note for this individual, you know, definitely his wife should get tested before she comes. And then I
yeah,
would have
before
her
Dan.
Quarantine. Yeah, I would have her quarantine before they see each other. So she needs to be in a separate part of the house or a separate part of something, you know, for a minimum of 5 days. We ideally say, you know, 14 before they connect and hopefully even test, you know, when she gets to Massachusetts.
Don't let her near you, Dan, is the bottom line here.
Let's try to squeeze another one in for the doctor. Yeah. Susan from the North Shore, you're on with Dr. Catherine Gergen-Barnett. Hi, Susan.
Hi there. Well, you guys have partly answered this already with respect to access to testing.
Yep.
I've been in a group like Marjorie and decided I should probably get a test and went on the CVS site and was told basically after I answered all the questions that I didn't qualify. I have to have symptoms if I want to get it through my primary care. The local, you know, quick clinic requires a visit with a physician, and it just seems like there are so many barriers. And I'm not sure where else I can turn to try and get tested.
So, Susan, you can always say you were at a protest. But no, I mean, there are places that you can go to that are drive-through that you can pay out of pocket. You know, I would actually get your PCP on the phone and kind of spend time with him or her going through some options. And I'm really hopeful that this is, you know, kind of in our rear view mirror soon. I know that we have the capacity in Massachusetts to offer a lot more tests. So I think expanding the criteria that people...
Yeah, I think that was really part of the interesting part for me is that Governor Baker had talked about access through CVS.
Yes.
But on their site, one of the, you know, the question about whether you'd been at a protest or, you know, large gathering or whatever wasn't even one of the questions.
Yeah. Well, they need to clearly update their form. But you know, I hear everything you're saying, and I think it needs to be part of the continued work we do with policymakers about the importance of offering these tests to everybody.
Susan, thanks for the call. We only have 45 seconds, Doctor, but very quickly, these at-home tests, I heard something on the radio in the middle of the night last night. Are they close to being reliable and available? What's the status of that?
I think we're getting closer. I haven't heard any kind of more recent data on their what we call specificity and sensitivity in terms of how good they are telling you whether or not you have COVID. But, you know, look, I think there are a lot of medical devices that have been made for really good testing at home, and we have every incentive to start to do this for at-home COVID tests. So, I'm cautiously optimistic.
Doctor, we really appreciate giving us so much time yet again. You're great.
Yeah, thank you
really
very much.
Thank you. I have so much fun with you all. Thank you for everything.
We really enjoy it. Thanks.
Very calming. Very calming, Doctor. Thank you.
Unlike you, Marjorie.
All right. Bye.
Well, I'm in a constant panic about everything, Jim. Dr. Catherine Gergen-Barnett is the Vice Chair of the Primary Care Innovation and Transformation and Residency Director in the Department of Family Medicine at Boston Medical Center, as well as Boston University Medical Center. Thanks again to Dr. Catherine Gergen-Barnett. Coming up, we're opening the lines and asking you about Whole Foods sending its employees home for wearing Black Lives Matter masks. What to do about Whole Foods? This is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, when President Trump retweeted a video of one of his supporters yelling white power, the White House said he really might not have known what he was doing. Well, how about when he claimed that protesters fighting racial injustice also wanted to tear down statues of Jesus? Even if the president is not racist, he has a penchant for stoking racial tensions. But in the wake of massive protests against systemic racism, has America finally had enough? In a few minutes, we'll ask the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price when they're here for All Revved Up.
After 5 years, John Stewart is back, and he's trying to figure out the current political moment. Bearded and older, Stewart is taking his comedy to the silver screen and stepping behind the camera for his newest film that he wrote and directed, Irresistible. The movie tells the story of local politics in our polarized era, but can Stewart rekindle the magic of The Daily Show? Later, we'll ask our TV man, Bob Thompson. He's ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. So Whole Foods is resisting the resistance. Even though their homepage declares, this is a quote, racism has no place here, it turns out being vocal about racism has no place at Whole Foods. Whole Foods across the country, including right here in Cambridge, including my go-to Whole Foods on River Street, by the way, Marjorie.
Oh, no, Jim.
Is sending workers home who are sporting Black Lives Matter masks, and we're opening the lines asking you if they should. 877-301-8970. If Whole Foods publicly denounces racism, should their workers also be allowed to individually reinforce company policy? Are you deliberately going to do to businesses that are displaying their support for Black Lives Matter? Should employees have their convictions, keep them to themselves, or should they not have to? 877-301-8970. I think I know where you are on this, but where are you, Marjorie?
Well, I think the question for a lot of us, Jim, is how deep are our convictions here? You know, are we going to stop going to Whole Foods? But I think, to me, because of the moment we're in and the time we're in, this is an exception. Generally speaking, I do think you can say you can't do political statements, you can't do other kinds of things on your T-shirts and stuff like that. But I would make an exception for this because of the moment we're in. And it's not really a political statement. I think it's a state that Black lives have not mattered for centuries in the United States of America. So it's time to assert that they do. And, you know, as Yvonne Abraham writes in her piece, I mean, Jeff Bezos is positioning himself as a great person on race relations, not getting that much money considering how much he's got, but he's not consistent. You know, he's not worried about white supremacist paraphernalia on his platform at Amazon. He's not. You know, he should get rid of facial technology, facial recognition technology, etc. But you know something? What this really comes down to is thinking about how we've seen the enemy and it's us. You know, most of us that are Whole Foods customers are not going to stop going. Just like most of us who know Amazon does terrible things are still buying things from Amazon, and most of us who know Apple and other computer manufacturers and other big tech companies do awful things like Facebook, and we're still participating. So
a lot of corporations are no longer doing ads on Facebook, at least for the time being.
I know, but how many people do you know spend half their lives, you know, sharing pictures of their children's graduations and or what passes for graduations now on Facebook. So we are not, remember that great line at the beginning of this whole pandemic thing that said the greatest generation was asked to lay down their life for their country We're asked to sit in our couch for COVID-19. I don't know that Americans, and I include myself because I'm buying still from Amazon and I have an Apple phone, etc. We're not very willing to stand up for our principles, even when the sacrifices asked of us are not that big.
Well, I would argue I totally agree with that, and I think I was the king of that theory until tens and hundreds of thousands of people took to the street day after day after day after day. And, you know, we're going to talk to Shirley Leung in about 20 minutes about the fact that
they may still be buying from Amazon, Jim.
We're going to talk to Shirley Leung in about 20 minutes about how people like her writing about it, and Jack Connors and Larry Malter and some pretty Joe Kennedy, powerful people in town, said they're not going to go to the Four Seasons, to the Bristol Lounge, after they screwed some of their longtime workers out of layoff benefits, and they retreated. So It seems to me, by the way, what you said is totally right before. I didn't read Yvonne's column yet, but I think you said she said it there, but the commenters are saying it too. This is not on the original stories that Katie Johnson and Shirley Leung wrote. not Shirley, Katie Johnson, I guess, is this is not a political statement. This is a factual statement. And one of the commenters I was looking said, well, what if it turns out Jesus loves you was a statement? Well, that's not the company policy right now. You can't really have it both ways. This is a very different time. And by the way, to add to your Amazon, your Bezos point, remember when he gave $10 billion or whatever the hell he gave to climate change at the same time that he had just fired two of his workers who were criticizing the climate change policies of Amazon? He's a fraud. I mean, you buy good public relations. So I would argue it's a different time. It's the company policy. I have seen people wearing Red Sox hats at that very same store on River Street.
Patriots hats.
And Patriots hats during the... So this is... And the last thing I'll say is there's a great line from a young... I think he's 19 years old, a young black man who works there, who in one of the stories in the Globe makes the point that most of the managers here are white people and most of the staff, or at least a lot of the staff, are black people. And... they got to get with the program, Whole Foods.
Well, hold on,
Yeah.
This isn't the last thing you're going to say. I just want to be clear.
Okay.
You're boycotting. We're not going to see you at the River Street.
I have not been to River Street Whole Foods since this whole thing.
There are other Whole Foods, Jim's.
What's that?
Jim.
I'm sorry.
There are other Whole Foods.
I have not been to the River Street Whole Foods. No, in all seriousness,
you know,
I am shopping.
It's going to be really painful for me to give up Whole Foods at the moment.
Well,
you know why?
Because right around the corner, I know that.
The nectarines are coming in.
No, but in all seriousness, I am not
pure. But I'm going to have to do it. Where will I go?
I am not pure, but I've shopped a hell of a lot less there,
Okay.
In the last handful of days than I usually go, you know, either at the end of the day or the beginning of the day when the crowds are fairly small. And I've done a lot less there, and I'm going elsewhere. I mean, this is really... Again, I might have some sympathy for the decision the employer made if Jeff Bezos and Amazon and Whole Foods were not trumpeting their support for this movement. But since they are, you got to walk the walk as well. So my attitude is let them do it. And in fact, I would argue they should encourage them to be. You know, one last thing here. Do you know the NBA? Which I assume is a lot more worried about losing conservative fans who don't. Well, by the way, even if you're conservative, you should endorse Black Lives Matter. Those who don't like the whole concept of Black Lives Matter, people like Mike Pence, who said on TV over the weekend that it troubles him because all lives matter, whatever insane thing he had to say. I don't know if those were exact words. Whatever it was pathetic. Why won't you say Black Lives Matter? And he came up with some convoluted answer. The NBA is contemplating allowing the players to take their names off the back of the jerseys and put a political slogan supporting social and racial justice on there. Yeah. If the NBA could do it, I would assume a supermarket. And by the way, this is in Cambridge, not that they shouldn't do it system-wide. This is in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they don't have the courage of their convictions. It is pathetic.
Okay, Ron from Billerica. What do you think, Ron?
Hey, Ron.
Good morning, guys. How are you all?
Good.
Good.
What I think is that this has been a longstanding company policy, and this is not the time to change it. What's going to be next? You know, if it's going to be their employees want to wear pro-white superiority slogan, so we're going to tell them no. Where do we draw the line?
Well, I'll tell you where we draw the line. Ron, the company policy and Jeff Bezos' policy is not a white supremacist policy. If it turns out they were saying only white lives matter or whatever your point is here, that might be a different kettle of fish. This is one of the most important movements that we've seen in decades. And by the way, if they can
wear...
Oh, you do?
I just want to say I agree with you. I think it's been the company's policy all along, and they should keep going, and I'm going to give up my time for somebody else so we can get more points of view. Thank you all for the great job.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you very much.
Testing us, I guess, is
thank you very much
the
for
notion.
The call. Let's go to Fiona in Salisbury. Hi, Fiona.
Hey, Fiona.
Hi, good. Hi, I love your show. I always listen.
Thank you.
Makes my travel time a lot shorter.
Great.
Thank you.
I'd just like to say I think it's wonderful that people are standing up for Black Lives Matter. I used to live down south, and I've seen discrimination. I've worked in restaurants. I've heard comments, the white girls wait in the – this was back in the 90s. The white girls wait on tables. The black girls are in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. But I also don't agree with wearing – what your beliefs are on your work uniform to a job. I think it opens up the doors for the Confederate flag, for the Nazis, you know, people that are that have other beliefs, and I just think it would, I just don't think it's a good thing to do in the workplace.
But Fiona, once again, this is company. This is company policy. All these workers are doing is wearing a mask that on it is written what the company says it embraces. It isn't like they're outliers. They're advancing the company's policy on their face masks, on their face coverings.
Well, I work for a large delivery company, and we are not even allowed to wear the wrong colored socks. So you are not allowed to wear anything, any advertising on the trucks, on our uniforms. It's just, it's a company policy.
Mm-hmm.
People, I mean, I want to go in a grocery store and not look at someone wearing a Confederate flag, a Trump sweater. I just, to me, that would be offensive. I'm not a supporter.
Got it.
I just think you go to work, you wear your uniform, and you leave it at that. And you can put your Black Lives Matter mask on as you leave.
That is essentially what Amazon's policy, I mean, what the Whole Foods policy is. Fiona, thank you for sharing your perspective. We appreciate it.
I assume they must be doing this at Whole Foods because they're worried about losing business, correct?
I don't think, well, I don't know about other parts of the country. I would say, and let me, the most recent Globe, Suffolk, WGBH poll said something like 80%+ of whites supported Black Lives Matter. So if 80% of whites support Black Lives Matter in Massachusetts, I would say roughly 99.99% of the people who shop at River Street probably support
about,
Black
then?
Lives Matter. I think it is anal adherence to a management rule book with absolutely no thinking. You know what it's, I know we're going to talk about this with Shirley, so I don't mean to preempt it. Do you think if the people at Four Seasons thought for a minute, a high-end hotel that's got a ton of dough, that they should try to screw their laid-off workers out of some money? Think if they thought about it for a minute, they might have said, this is probably a bad idea and not going to be worth it terms of the negative publicity we get.
I thought they could get away with it and didn't obviously anticipate the negative publicity that they would get. And if not for the much maligned media, we wouldn't even know about it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Shirley Nunn wrote the story.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, theoretically, the dress code says you're not supposed to be wearing anything with logos or whatever. But as I said, I say this to you on the air or off the air.
Somebody had a Patriots.
Right. Yeah, Patriots Super Bowl time, they always have Patriots stuff on.
Right.
From head to toe, frankly. World Series time, or at least the opening of the season when the season's used to open, they had Red Sox paraphernalia. I'm not saying it's a political statement, but that's technically in violation of the dress code, too. Again, by the way, I would feel far less strongly about this had Bezos and Amazon not taken the position. And again, you read this quote from the original Globe story. Jeff Bezos, I'm going to read, posted a letter on social media from a customer attacking the company's support for Black Lives Matter, replying, quote, "You're the kind of customer I'm happy to lose." Well, if you're not worried about the customer, you're worried about principle, then what the hell is the concern about a worker at your store wearing a Black Lives Matter face mask?
You know, here's a good one. This is from Robert. I shop at my local Arlington Whole Foods at least 3 times a week. The company has no problem asking me to donate a buck or two for some such cause every time I go in there so they can turn around and present some giant check to some organization, making themselves look good. Yet when their employees try to get behind a cause that costs zero, they're silent. That is a good point. They're always asking you to donate to something at Whole Foods, aren't they?
And, it's voluntary kind of thing. And by the way, congratulations to these mostly very young employees who are putting themselves at risk. The woman who started this thing, Kinzer, I don't remember her first name. I think she just started in April, isn't that what I read? And by the way, I should continue and say the vast majority, I didn't read all the comments. One of our coworkers sent us a lot of them. The vast majority of commenters seem to be saying that, one, while they support the Black Lives Matter movement, they support Amazon's decision, sort of like the first couple of callers or the last caller, being able to enforce a down-the-line, even-handed dress code.
Andrew thinks we should do the reverse of what Public did during the Market Basket revolt a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Shop at Market Basket, Hannaford, Shaw, Stop and Shop, whatever. Tape your receipts to the door of your local Whole Foods store.
That's a good one. Let's go to Laura and Lynn. You're on Boston Public Radio with Marjorie Egan and me, Jim Browdy. Hi.
Hi, Hi, thank you so much for accepting my call.
Sure.
I agree with you 100%. I think that if it's a company policy, if it's a statement they're publicly making, and for example, for in LinkedIn, I think they should be 100% allowing their employees to wear pins, to wear masks. I think what we have seen in the past couple of weeks is a lot of companies coming out with their fancy statements that they believe in it. And I think that this is when they truly walk the talk. And I think it just highlights how much, how full of it Whole Foods could be, to be honest. I think it highlights just like the Bezos Earth Fund. Like, is it really offsetting anything? Is it really helping the environment when you consider how wealthy this man is and how what corners were cost to create the wealth that this man has? So I think that his statements are catering to us, to consumers, because I am a Whole Foods consumer. But to be honest, if I had access to a local organic shop that was owned by a mom and pop, believe me, I would never support Whole Foods. But because here in Massachusetts, we don't have that option. It's kind of like our only option that we have to support brands that we believe in, that, you know, are produced in an ethical way, that are produced in a sustainable way. So I think that I think that the Whole Foods that exists today is not the same Whole Foods that existed a couple of years ago. And I think that, yeah it's super disappointing.
Yeah.
Laura, thanks.
Yeah.
Remember way back when it was Bread and Circus?
Well, at least some of it was, yeah, in Cambridge, I guess it was. You know, Marjorie, you know, I don't like to brag, but, you know, one of the ways I solve the problem that Laura from Lynn just broached is I grow all my own food, as you know, which is...
Well, Jim, I think the question is,
makes it a lot easier, so you don't have to worry.
If the hot bar were still operating at Whole Foods, would you still be boycotting? I suspect you wouldn't be boycotting.
Can I tell you,
there is one of their features.
There is not a time I have been in a Whole Foods since this all started.
So disappointing.
Where I don't look at it and practically weep. I mean, the hot bar experience.
Especially if you're going out on a Saturday morning to get some stuff for breakfast. And, you know, usually if you have company or whatever, they have the huge vat of the cooked bacon. You know, you don't even have to bother to cook it at home. You just cook the bacon. It's expensive, but there it is. You know, you can come home with this entire mat, like 40 pieces of bacon, Jim.
Do you know what Azita, our coworker who works with me on our television show,
time.
Every Friday, we were never at the station anymore on Friday because we used to go to the library, which we hopefully will do again soon. Every Friday, she would fill up literally like a suitcase with bacon from the hot bar at Whole Foods and bring it in for people in the newsroom.
Denied.
It is a dream denied. Beautifully put, Marjorie. Where do you want to go?
Robin Lawrence, thank you for calling.
Welcome, Rob.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello. Yeah, we can.
Yep.
I just wanted to say I don't support Black Lives Matter. Number one, outright. That is a political statement. While I understand the sentiment, it's a political statement. I think it's completely appropriate for any company to say, you know, we don't have political messages, you know, in the workplace. I think that's completely, completely appropriate.
Can we get back to the first part? Sorry. Go ahead.
Why don't you support Black Lives Matter, Rob?
I support the notion that Black Lives Matter. I don't support the organization, and people are not making a distinction. I'm a Black person, and I don't support that organization.
Why not?
I don't support the idea that all lives matter, because we're all human beings, we're all Americans. That's what I support. I don't support the notion.
Oh, okay.
You know, I don't. The problem here is that people think that people are accepting the narrative that police are killing Black men. No, they're not. Most of the people who are killing Black men are young Black men. That's the truth. Like 96% of it, somewhere like that, cops kill very few Black men. And cops actually kill more white men than they kill Black men. That's the truth. Look it up.
Rob, if I may respectfully make a three-word comment, are you kidding me? Oh, that's four-word. comment. Is, by the way, when you say, well, all lives matter, and by all lives matter, most of our lives, like Marjorie's and mine, have always mattered. Black lives have never mattered. And it's a focus for those of us who want to try to make up for what this country has left behind and punished for so many years. And secondly, do you, have you, watch the videos of what some police officers have done to your fellow young black?
I've seen those videos,
and?
But everybody's talking about Lord George Floyd. Nobody's talking about Tony Timpa, the white man that this happened to in Dallas, I believe.
And what is it? And I don't know who that is, but let's assume that's true. What in the hell does it have to do with? Excuse me, Rob. I let you finish a sentence. You'll let me finish a sentence. Even if that's true, how in any way does that take away from the execution of George Floyd at the hand of former Officer Chauvin and his three colleagues? What does that have to do with it? How does that in any way minimize the horror of what we saw, Rob?
I am not trying to minimize the horror, sir.
I think you are.
I am simply saying, let me finish, please.
You're right. My apologies.
I am not trying to minimize the horror. I am saying that that horror extends to white men as well. That is what I am saying. And if you would look at the data, you would find that to be true. And if more people understood that, we could look at this as a police training problem and more people of different races could come together about it, because that's the truth of what's happening.
Rob, races are coming together in unprecedented fashion behind a movement that, respectfully, you think is the wrong one, but I know most of America thinks is the right one, particularly for this time. But, Rob, thank you for sharing your thoughts. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970.
Let's go to Sarah in West Roxbury. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Sarah.
Hi. Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Thanks for taking my call. Love
sure.
you guys.
Thanks.
And
thank you.
You were absolutely right in your earlier point about Bezos basically buying cheap publicity, but maybe not standing up behind the statement that his company made with respect to Black Lives Matter. I think if he were really sincere about this being company-wide support and policy, he should have issued some sort of button or uniform or something for the Whole Foods employees to wear, stating Black Lives Matter and stating their support. You know, doing something like that, I heard a lot of callers saying, well, where does it end? Why can't white supremacists proclaim their message then on their Whole Foods uniform? If the company was sincere about it, they should back it up in a very visible way and not just a press release.
Sarah, thank you for your call. I mean, it is one of the beauties of being in Jeff Bezos' position is you can take all positions. In your work, you can do one thing, and then you hold a press conference, put out a release, and donate a significant amount of money, and you can take another. And he has done that artfully, I'd say.
I think that's kind of what this moment is about, isn't it? I mean, Yvonne Abraham has in her column in the Globe that, you know, there are a lot of bankers, you know, wringing their hands over the racism their black workers have been subjected to. But as she writes, they have to consider the decades of redlining and predatory mm-hmm. lending practices that they've been doing as banks and academics have, you know, all these colleges and stuff are wringing their hands saying this is terrible. Then you have all these stories about black students and black professors being enduring these horrible racist insults as teachers and stuff. So it's kind of like a moment where we all have to think about where we are, and that's what I think makes this different. You know, you just can't say, well, I'm not a racist, and then not do anything. You have to do something, I think.
Well, it gets back. I referenced this woman. Of course, I can never remember her name, which is totally disrespectful. The woman is with us from Drake, I believe, in Iowa, who is saying, you know, we've pretended for years that being non-racist, to use her term, was adequate. And if you're not affirmatively and aggressively anti-racist, you're full of it, which many of us have been for far too long. So we got to take a break, Marjorie. Thank you for your calls. We appreciate it.
Yep, coming up, we're going to talk to the Globe, Shirley Leung, about how corporate America is responding to racial inequality. She is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. As protests and rallies against racial injustice continue, the business world is having a reckoning. In Boston, that means looking at how much money the city is investing in minority businesses. And for corporate America, it means pledging multi-millions to fight racism. Join us online to talk about this, a major reversal of misfortune for laid-off four-season employees, which we referenced a few minutes ago, and other business headlines, is Shirley Leung. Shirley is a business columnist. She is the business columnist for the Boston Globe and a GBH contributor. Hi, Shirley.
Hi.
Hey, before
Shirley,
we get started, can we mention
go
what
ahead,
she
Jim.
Just texted us? Are we allowed to say that on the air or not?
Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
First day of summer camp for my kids.
And they're masked up. How's that going? How much trepidation is there? How much anxiety?
There is a lot of anxiety. I feel like I'm living dangerously sending my kids to camp today. I was driving them to basketball camp today. It's just a day camp. They're gone for, you know, 5 or 6 hours out of the house. Mm. They have not been out of the house, you know, without a parent, you know, for 5 or 6 hours a day since mid-March. I mean, and so they have not really, because, you know, we haven't really gone anywhere. I've been working from home all this time. And, Jim, you had asked me if they seem excited. They were a little nervous. I think they were more nervous about going to an all-day basketball camp than actually about the virus. But, you know, they were masked up. You know, I had to sign COVID waivers, hand sanitizer waivers. There's no water fountains, so you have to pack enough water for the day. So, I mean, luckily, for my 9-year-old, he misses his friends. And so he has some friends who are going to the camp. So that's nice. So it kind of feels like they're in school again. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a full report.
Please.
Next week when they're back.
Shirley
Leung. Thank you, Shirley.
Living dangerously. Who would have thought?
I'm living dangerously sending my kids to camp, you know?
Yeah, you're on the edge.
On one hand, I want them to have a somewhat normal summer. But on the other hand, I mean, we haven't done this in 4 months,
sure.
Right?
We've not
done this. Let them out of the house and out of our sight. And you know, they'll be, as I understand, the adults, the counselors will have masks, but not the kids, you know, and the kids won't have masks. So social distancing while they play basketball. I'm not sure how that works, but it seems like.
Sorry, I asked.
Got it under control. You know, I told my kids when they come home today, they have to strip to their underwear, like in the basement, strip to the underwear and go straight to get a shower. You know, it's like that will be the role. And if you know what the 7-year-old said, this is like, do I have to keep my underwear on when I'm in the shower? It's like, no, you can take it off then.
Glad you clarified that for the kid. We're talking to Shirley Leung, camp mother extraordinaire.
So, Shirley Leung, you had a great column about the Four Seasons Hotel. Tell us what you discovered there and the reaction.
Yeah, this actually started with my colleague Katie Johnston. She wrote a story about nearly a couple hundred Four Season workers who got laid off, and of course, a lot of hotels are suffering and they're closed because of the pandemic. And the restrictions on travel, and she wrote that, you know, so her story was about these workers coming together and trying to get better. They were laid off, but they didn't get their full severance. And what happened was that the Four Seasons has a clause. This is a non-union hotel, and they have a clause saying that in the event of a national emergency, we do not have to pay you your full severance. And so what happened was that some of these workers, they had worked there for 20 years or you know, many, many years, and they didn't get their full severance. They only got part of their severance. And so they came together and they, worked with a labor union to try to, get the Four Seasons to reverse their decision. And then they went to the Globe, initially with my colleague Katie Johnson, and then I wrote a follow-up, and my follow-up was talking to the patrons of the Four Seasons, in particular in the business community, everybody, including, I've learned you and Marjorie, Jim and Marjorie, you, both of you, you go to, you also go to the Bristol Lounge, which is the very nice restaurant.
That's right.
And bar
as often as I can.
On Boylston Street. And it's a who's who. If you, you know, I've been there, you know, I go there with, you know, you often like have lunch with the CEO or a lunch with or breakfast with the CEO. You run into members of Congress. It's the who's who there. Yeah. And so I did a follow-up story to Katie saying, would you go back to the Bristol knowing how they treated their employees? Will you say something? And I found a lot of them said, I'm not going back until they do the right thing, until they treat these workers right. And one of the reasons why I think the story resonated with a lot of readers and customers is that the Four Seasons is nothing without the people who
yeah.
work there. And a lot of the employees at the Bristol Lounge had worked there for many years. I mean, I think we quoted one a server who had been there since he was 19 and he's 40 now. He has spent his, half his life at the Four Seasons. And for them to treat them that way, they just felt like they didn't understand what the Four Seasons are all about. And this story rose, you know, the Four Seasons in Boston, this story rose to the highest levels of the Four Seasons, to the CEO. And within a week, they reversed their decision. They decided to grant the 192 employees that they laid off their full severance. And also I think they might, they still want to keep talking. Some of these employees still want to keep talking to the Four Seasons. They want to know how can we get our job back eventually when the business comes back. And so, but this got the attention of Senator Markey, who met with some workers. Congressman Kennedy also made a few calls on their behalf, and so that the workers would get their get treated right, and hopefully they'll get their job back eventually.
Well, just one last note, though. While it's great that under pressure, Four Seasons did what they should have done to begin with, when I was reading the final piece, I can't remember if you wrote it or who wrote it, that they have to reapply for their jobs, and the employer says they'll have a priority. Why should they have a priority? Why shouldn't they just get their jobs back? If it turns out that the company rehires, why shouldn't they rehire automatically the people who they laid off who worked there for years? And the only reason they would ever do that, and I think the union indicates this is the reason in the piece, is because they want to hire people who are cheaper, who haven't dedicated right. their lives to the place for a decade or right. two. So I have to say, well, this is great progress, even though it shouldn't have had to have been had. Until they say they automatically get the jobs when the jobs are reposted, I think they are still getting away with murder here. So it's a good first step, but it's not enough. That's my two cents.
So,
we're talking to Shirley Young.
Shirley Young, a story by one of your colleagues, two of them, Zoe Greenberg and Tim Logan, about a tsunami of evictions. They focus in on this one woman, Annie Gordon, who's older. She's on a fixed income. She's lived in her apartment complex for 44 years. And now she's researching how to enter a homeless shelter.
Heartbreaking.
And the quote from this guy from Corcoran Management,
Keith Driscoll,
says, "Hey, after the moratorium, it's typical business as usual." He didn't say the "hey," that's me. Quote, "after the moratorium, it's typical business as usual." I haven't heard anything so heartless, at least in 24 hours. Who are these Corcoran management
at least
people? And
in 24
what's going
hours.
On?
Hours.
Yeah. What's, are there any options for people like this poor woman?
Right. I mean, I don't know if you read our stories last week about Eastern Standard
yes,
Eastern Standard,
the restaurant,
Hotel Commonwealth.
Yes.
And they're also in a fight with their landlord. They're trying to get some rent relief or at least some negotiate a better rent situation, given that the restaurant business is not back to normal and won't be back to normal for a while. And you get the sense that the landlords in general are are taking a tough stance. And they, you know, I don't know what's going on the back end of real estate investment companies, or I guess landlords, because, you know, sometimes they might own the property. They also might have a big mortgage themselves, and so they need these renters to be paying. But it's a tough situation all around. And I think what's really interesting that perhaps, you know, the Eastern Standard story, you know, revealed was that I think landlords all, maybe the landlords are hanging tough because they also want to bail out too, is my impression. They know there's a lot of government money floating out there. And I think everybody is trying to take a tough stance and see who, you know, I think our story in the last story, the Eastern Standard, it was a case of brinkmanship, you know, who can blink first. And that's what I think is happening with these tenants and these landlords. It's a real standoff, and they're just seeing, you know, who can outlast the other. And luckily for the tenants right now, there is a moratorium on evictions.
But only till mid-August, isn't it?
Yeah, August 18th. Right. But I guess the thing is, to me, it's one thing if you're a small landlord, you know, you got to worry about your mortgage, but there's a moratorium on that, too. But you could, you know, you're worried about you're getting by yourself. But usually, big real estate management companies are not, you know, that close to the vest. I mean, they have a lot of money usually, don't they?
They do, and they also tend to be the ones because they're so distant, or they're not on the ground, so they might not have the same they might not have much sympathy or empathy for their tenants. And so
yeah.
But there's got to be, I mean, this is a really, I think our story talked about a tsunami of evictions that could be coming, and this is going to be a huge problem once the moratoriums are gone. And I guess we have some time to figure it out, but hopefully we'll fix it in time.
By the way, just people know, there's a bill pending filed by Connolly from Cambridge and Kevin Honan from Alston, which would extend the moratorium for a year and provide some relief, mortgage deferral for small landlords. And that's pending if people want to weigh in on whatever their position is with legislators. And in terms of the federal government, my recollection is the House bill that is now going nowhere in the Senate has a ton of dough in it for renters who are on the edge. And if you care about that, you should probably talk to, of course, the two senators here probably support it.
I just can't get over this story. 44 years in this apartment, and now she's looking for a homeless shelter.
Yeah, she wants to know how to apply for a homeless.
It's heartbreaking.
Well, feel free to call Corcoran Management, too, maybe, and tell them what your position is in terms of this woman. 44 years there is just, it's unbelievable. You know, you wrote a story, and I'm looking for some clarification. You're the person to get it from. 19 business leaders have put together an organization called the New Committee on Racial Equity and Social Justice Fund,
The new Commonwealth Fund.
They're hoping to raise $100 million. And the thing I don't quite understand is, on television last week, I spoke to two people from the Black Economic Council, I believe it's of Massachusetts, BECMA, who are trying to raise $1 million. The mayor is with us on Friday. He was talking about the mayor's racial equity fund, where they're trying to raise a ton of money. What's the difference? What's the overlap? And I guess, much more importantly, what's the goal? What's the game plan here?
Well, in terms of BECMA, two things. They're looking to raise money to kind of to strengthen their organization. So they're hoping to become a bigger player, but they need more resources. BECMA also put out a call out, the business community to create a $1 billion fund right over the next decade, and so they've just to close the racial wealth gap. And that's more of an open end. They're not raising the money. They're just putting out the challenge to the business community.
So they are raising $1 million themselves because the guy was who donated $100,000 to this first $1 million they're trying to raise. Yeah,
right. That's $1 million for their own organization. But
in terms
of the $1 billion, they're not raising the billion. They're challenging the business community to create a fund. So you could see what the city is doing, the city of Boston is doing, and is what these now 19 black and brown business leaders are doing. They're raising money, and that will go in, those will fund organizations that do racial justice, social justice work or racial equity work. You know, I talked to Shagun from BECMA, and he's sorting out, you know, he's eager to work with the black and brown business leaders to look at what they're doing. Maybe there's a way to merge their efforts or combine their efforts. Mm. I mean, they all say they're collaborating on one level. But when I look at what the city is doing, and I look at what the New Commonwealth is doing, I mean, the New Commonwealth have carved out a very different path in terms of raising money. They have $20 million already in hand. They're looking to raise $100 million. And their whole kind of take on philanthropy and corporate giving is that we want to raise money. And we as black and brown business leaders, we have been doing this kind of work for a long, long time. You know, a lot of them already give individually to racial equity and social justice, you know, nonprofits and organizations and causes. They say that now they want to raise their own money, and they want to be able to direct the money, you know, raise their own money from themselves, but also from their respective corporations. And they also want to prioritize giving the money to black and brown-led nonprofits doing this work. Mm-hmm. One of the things I had never heard of the term, you've heard of the term redlining, as it relates to banking, but there is something called philanthropic redlining, where it almost reminded me more of the plight of black founders of companies and women founders of companies, where they can't get VC money. It's very hard to raise money because the VC world is predominantly white. It's predominantly male, and it sounds like the same thing is happening in philanthropy. It's very hard as a black or brown-led nonprofit to raise money from a predominantly community of white funders. And, you know, some of the, you know, they look at, and the studies have shown that they're chronically underfunded black and brown-led nonprofits, and they don't have as money, as many assets as their white-led counterparts. And so this black and brown group, the New Commonwealth, they want to level the playing field. They want to. They think the work that will drive systemic change is happening at the grassroots and happening at these underfunded groups. And so they want to empower them. And also, what was really interesting talking to this group is that there's been a philosophy in giving that focuses on almost a white savior complex. And they said that they wanted to give money in a way that changes that relationship. It's less about being a savior and more about being a partner in driving change. And I thought that was a really, like, I never thought of it that way. And I was thinking, you know, they're white. And also, if you think about it, there's been a lot of money given to closing the racial wealth gap and, you know, right, social justice, but it hasn't moved the needle far enough or fast enough. So what happens if what if we take a crack at it? Why don't we take a crack at it, those of us with these lived experiences? Why don't, and with the network, why don't we give us a chance? And I think that's what's so powerful about this group. And, you know, some of them, you know, it's from
you know, and a lot of them are CEOs and presidents themselves, you know, you know, the Eastern Bank president, Quincy Miller, Corey Thomas, the CEO of Rapid7 is part of this group. You have Mo Cowan, who is the president at General Electric, overseeing the global affairs. So it's a real who's who of the black and brown community in Boston coming together. You don't see them coming together like this. I don't think I've seen ever seen them come together like this.
Shirley, can I ask one quick question, though, about this? We're a little short on time. Is there not going to be behind-the-scenes competition between some of the more traditional foundations in town that are overwhelmingly white-run, who believe that they are doing important work, whether that's true or not, in communities of color, and this new $100 million goal organization? Do you know what I mean? I mean, there's only a finite amount of money. I assume it's going to come down to, at some point, leaders of this new group saying your money's better spent here, no?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a real issue, if whether or not there'll be having this group in, it'll be just competing for a smaller pie. I think what they'll say is we want to grow the pie.
Sure.
And I do think there is a moment where, you know, I wrote a story earlier saying that there are a lot of companies, you know, pledging $100 million for racial equity and social justice, and including Bain Capital is pledging $100 million over the next decade. So there's a lot of money out there. And so I think they're trying to hopefully, you know, this country and you know, we'll see that while people and companies have been giving money to fix, you know, race relations, it's not nearly enough. And so I think there is, this is a moment where the pie will grow.
I hope so.
We're talking with Shirley Leung from the Boston Globe. Shirley, you had another terrific piece about how Boston is not spending as much giving contracts to minority women-owned businesses as other cities across the country. 7% here in Boston last year versus 19% in New York, 29% in Chicago, 31% in Philadelphia. We are really way behind. What's the story?
You know, this is something that the Walsh administration, Mayor Walsh, has been trying to tackle since 2016. I think if you look earlier, I think City Councilor Ayanna Pressley, you know, she was doing this work even before, before she's been for years, and now she's a congresswoman, but she's been talking for years about the need for the city to step up its contracting with minority-owned businesses and women-owned businesses. Mayor Walsh is, I think he's done two executive orders now, but when you talk to businesses, when you talk to city councilors like Michelle Wu or the city council president Kim Janey, they just feel that the city hasn't been aggressive enough in terms of trying to fix their contracting, their procurement process. It needs to be even more transparent. One issue is perhaps they're issuing too many big contracts. If they broke them up, then small businesses, small businesses which tend to be minority and women owned, can go after them. And so And when you talk to groups like BECMA, you know, they said if you really want to close the racial gap, this is one of the levers the city has, which is to give out tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars, or I should say, of contracting work to minority-owned and women-owned businesses. I should say the city has made some progress. I think when the numbers were first reported last year, they were 1%, and then 4.5%, and then just under 5.5%. So now they're on track to do about 7%. So it's going in the right direction. But as you said earlier, Marjorie, you ticked off, you know, they're still in the single digits compared to double digits in other cities. And so I think that's another thing that I want to explore more, but why are the other cities so far ahead? What are they doing that Boston isn't?
Shirley, thanks.
Good luck with the day camp, Shirley.
I hope everything goes well at the day camp, Shirley.
Yes, I'll report back next week.
I hope so.
Living Dangerously, Lee Young, a Boston Globe business columnist. It's great to talk to you, Shirley. Thank you. Coming up, is it time to stop whitewashing Jesus? The Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price join us for that and more up next for this week's edition of All Revved Up. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan, Jim Browdy. Joining us online to take on the urgent moral dilemmas of the day are Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett G. Price III. Irene is a syndicated religion columnist, Boston voice for Detour's African American Heritage Trail, and a visiting researcher in the Religion and Conflict Transformation Program at BU's School of Theology. Emmett's professor and executive director of the Institute for the Study of the Black Christian Experience at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. They're the host of the All Revved Up podcast. Hello, Irene. Hello, Emmett.
Hey there.
Thanks for having us back.
Hey, yes. Great to talk to you. So the president was complaining last week about people taking down Confederate statues, heroes of the Confederacy, such as heroes in quotes. He also talked about taking down statues of Jesus Christ.
We have sound, by the way. We have sound.
Oh, we have sound. Oh, okay, let's go ahead.
Here's
and
the president.
Sound.
This is when he's telling reporters that activists, as Marjorie said, want to take down statues of Jesus, apparently, among others.
Now they're looking at Jesus Christ. They're looking at George Washington. They're looking at Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson. Not going to happen. Not going to happen. Not as long as I'm here.
I wonder, did I miss something? Did I miss something? Were there people that were circling around a Jesus Christ statue that I missed? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think
Marjorie,
so.
They. You don't know who they are? Come on, Marjorie.
Okay. Okay, so I guess as far as we know, the Jesus Christ statues are safe. Okay, we've established that. Now let's move on to this very fascinating question of how Jesus Christ did kind of morph from a guy who was almost certainly very dark-skinned and dark-haired and brown-eyed to a blue-eyed blonde. How'd this happen? Irene, if you want to go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say it happened very easily by the notion of anti-Semitism. I mean, we dehistoricalized Jesus. And what I mean by this is that we Christianized him and not recognized that he was a Jew during, you know, when he was living during a Roman occupation time that crucified him. I think that what's really very interesting here is that nobody's going into churches, whether you have a white Jesus or a brown Jesus. I think what we have to understand about one of the pillars of white supremacy is religion. I mean, the whole idea of slavery was not to make us, meaning black folks, better Christians, but actually, you know, better slaves. So the whole idea of now re-looking at Jesus, I'm hoping that while we may make him brown, we will also understand that he was also a Jew. Because, you know, Reverend William Barber at the 2016 DNC said this, that Jesus was a brown-skinned Palestinian Jew. Now deal with that.
Yeah.
That was one hell of a speech by Barber, I should say, at the Democratic National Convention a few years ago, too.
Emmett, you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what's interesting about the notion of the white Jesus is that this goes back to the Renaissance, between the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries, where you had, phenomenal painters like, Da Vinci and Michelangelo and Raphael and so many others who decided to imprint Jesus in a white Eurocentric normative, presentation. All along before that, all of the ancient iconography, all of the various representations of Jesus had him not just as a Jewish person, as Irene is talking about, but as somebody with a darker skin that would clearly represent where he came from. And so this is a tension. But I think what's interesting is the 1941 image of Jesus painted by Warner Solomon, which is the version that I grew up with. You know, a phenotypically white Jesus. You know, and I grew up in the Black Baptist Church in Los Angeles, and we had that picture, that same picture, on the fans in the church. As a picture at the back of the church, and in some of our Black homes, some of my family members had a picture of a white Jesus right next to a picture of a Black Martin Luther King Jr. in the dining room. So this is, I know this image.
Yeah, the Trinity, if you remember, Emmett, growing up, the Trinity wasn't so much the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, but it was MLK, JFK,
and
Jesus. But I think what we have to remember, a couple of things, we're still looking for the historical Jesus. So I think that in people making images, making Jesus in their own image, I'm okay with that. The reason why I'm okay with that is because Jesus symbolically symbolizes the oppressed, the damned, the dispossessed and disrespected. So then Jesus, then when he's on the cross, represents Black men who are being lynched. Well, you know, then Jesus represents Matthew Shepard, who is, you know, was killed and left on a kind of a crucifix. He becomes the pilgrims who are trying to land here because of, you know, religious persecution, or immigrants that are coming here. So if he is indeed the face of the dispossessed symbolically, then he can change into these various different, you know, images. My problem is what Emmett is describing is the hegemony of the white, blonde, blue-eyed, Scandinavian, you know, non-Jewish Jesus coming from a dark continent.
Well, you know, obviously, I state the obvious and then some. I mean, the cultural impact of this would have been huge through the years. And is this a time where there's going to be, I mean, we've had this discussion, I think, either with you two or without you two in different contexts through the years, but is this going to be a focus of this movement that is all around us, is to make Jesus look like what he actually looked like?
Well, I'm not so sure it's about making Jesus to look like what he actually looked like, because none of us were there. And if we were, then we have a whole nother issue to deal with. But I think it's really about making sure that we don't Jim and Jane Crow Jesus. See, the Confederate statues and the Confederate memorials and all these things didn't come up during slavery. They came up way after.
Right.
They came up during Jim and Jane Crow. And so the notion of this white Jesus, again, this is 1941. This has nothing to do with anything other than the fact that this is a sense of persecution that any Christian in the United States of America, perhaps, you know, just the United States and beyond, has to bow down to a white male, has to subject themselves and subordinate themselves to a Christianity that espouses white supremacy and white nationality in this sense. And that's the issue with this white.
But don't you think it goes further than that, Emmett? Well, go ahead, Irene. I'm sorry.
I do. I definitely do. I think that if we're going to correct history, then let's correct history.
Exactly. Why is this any different?
Right. And that's my point. And my point is that what we got to get at the root of being a Christian is how we either, it works the same way with white privilege, okay? There is a kind of Christian privilege that we got to deal with the fact that the man we honor was a Jew. And while we don't have an actual image of him, we certainly can have him look Jewish. It's as if we said he was African. And we certainly can say if he's coming from this region, this is the probability of what he looked like. So my point is that if we're going to correct history, let's also throw in anti-Semitism, particularly those of us who are Christian. Malcolm X was trying to, during his era in the 60s, move us from genuflecting to a white Christian, to a white Jesus. It was the Nation of Islam that gave us that image of a black Jesus and a black God. God. And then James Cone, who was my professor at Union Theological Seminary, then becomes the, you know, the godfather of Black theology. But he understood the malleability of it, that whoever suffers is the face of Jesus in that time. But if we're going, but what we need to do is go back to the history and say that that Last Supper was a Seder.
But, you know, I'm curious, because you guys are both reverends. I mean, if you're a Christian, I get you could paint Jewish or, Christ not to look Jewish. But the whole New Testament is full of, you know, he's preaching in the temple. He's at the temple. They're going doing Passover. I mean, the Judaism is everywhere. So how do they get around that if they're trying to pretend he's not Jewish?
Well, you don't.
Or is it just...
That's the challenge that we have in Christianity. Irene is right on the money, and I'm not disagreeing with her, but not all Christians are against Judaism. I mean, you know, the first Christians were Jewish in nature,
right,
in origin, in culture, and they decided to do something different. And so I think the challenge is you don't have to pin people in these 2x4 boxes and suggest that you're either this or you're that. I think that's the piece about it. I don't think Christianity needs to be anti-Judaism.
See, but I disagree with that. See, that's the same kind of argument we have that when we say white folks will say, well, I'm not racist. I mean, I support Black Lives Matter, but don't see it systemically how it manifests itself. We got to understand that the hegemony of Christianity is systemic. So unless we are preaching from our pulpits and we are insistent that the Jesus that we love, it was a Jew who suffered under a Roman occupation, we are complicit in our silence. You know, so this is what I grew up with. Not at all, but, you know, I grew up with people who will love Jesus but hate Jews. What's wrong with that picture? That picture is because we have dehistoricalized this suffering servant. And the problem with this notion of the suffering servant is that we say that Jesus died for our sins as opposed that he actually died because of our sins. And so the anti-Semitism that we see in America as well as across the board is the whole idea that, you know, that the Jews killed Jesus. It's
right.
Crazy. When actually it was the Roman Empire that killed Jesus. So I'm just saying that if this is the moment of reckoning, that's all I'm saying, that my job as a Christian minister is that while I am also fighting homophobia and racism, I need to also be fighting anti-Semitism and speak up against it every time I see it within the text, within a sermon, and among my Christian colleagues.
Okay, we're talking to the Reverends Emmett Price and Irene Monroe. So I suppose you can't be surprised at much anymore that the president does. But as everyone knows, he promoted this video on Twitter yesterday showing this guy in a golf cart in one of the weirdest performances in general I've seen in quite some time at this place called The Villages, his retirement community. Anyway, the guy was shouting white power. You heard it several times. They claim at the White House that he didn't really get that part. I assume neither of you are buying that claim.
I'm still you have to forgive me, Marjorie. I'm still stuck on the fact that let me be kind, that President Trump said a couple of weeks ago that he's done more for Christianity than Jesus Christ himself. I'm still there. So I can't even get to the golf cart. I'm still back there.
Yeah.
Well, it was a weird parade. I mean, all these people, these golf cars screaming and yelling at each other. It was just bizarre.
But
go ahead,
Irene.
I'm sorry.
The issue is that we understand that Trump traffics in racial tropes.
Yeah.
We saw this with the Central Park Five, but then we even saw it the day that he was rolling down this escalator and he talked about Mexicans. Some are rapists, you know, but some are good. Now, let's remember when Obama was running for office, he started the Bertha conspiracy. I think what my big issue is that we know this. This is nothing new about Trump. I just want to know, who are we as a people to be complicit with this kind of action? I mean, we're talking about trying to, I know the political divide, but I think Republicans and Democrats should unite against this and rebuke this type of language. It encourages racist behavior, you know, among a certain segment of the population. And a classic example is Althea Bernstein. This was a young 18-year-old little sister, biracial sister, who was at an intersection, and four white men just randomly, you know, burned her. And so it bothers me that they what they don't understand is that kind of racist language, when it's not rebuked, it emboldens people who have a tendency to act out, to do so on innocent people. And so here's this sister with, you know, second and third degree burns, which will heal, but this will never leave her. So that's what we got to see, the residual of the kind of damage that Trump does. I mean, it's not surprising that we've seen an uptick among, you know, hate crimes against LGBTQ, Mexican, anybody that is other. So that's the kind of stuff that we got to say, who are we as a people to stay silent? Because my question is, as we roll into November for an election, are we going to be a United States of America? Are we going to continue to be polarized as we are? And I don't think we can survive that.
Well, you know, but this is not pure polarization. I have to say, you know, the line, as Marjorie said, that is being spun by the White House is that he didn't hear this. And for those who have not watch the video, occasionally a comment like this, you have to really listen carefully.
No,
you don't have to listen carefully
here
at all. Here you have to do is listen for 5 or 10 seconds, and you hear it said twice, clearly and loudly. And if what the defenders in the White House, from McEnany and this guy Deere, who's an assistant PR person there, said, well, he took it down when he was alerted to the fact, if you want to buy that, which I assume most sane people do not, he didn't take it down and say it is wrong and I condemn people who say things like this. He just took it down because you got all you wanted. It's sort of like, I robbed the bank, here's your money back, and you achieved your purpose. He achieved his purpose. He did this dog whistle thing, and all of his those of his supporters who are racist, you know, applauded and loved every minute of it and probably laughed through it, just like those disgusting young people laughed when he did Kung Flu last week, wherever he was in Arizona. And so he achieved his goal. And, you know, you got to step back for a second. In the last 24 hours, we not only have this white power thing, we have credible reports that Vladimir Putin has put a bounty on U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. And it's sort of like, let's move on to the next Trump issue. These two stories in 2 days, it is really unbelievable.
You know,
and the fact, I'll just say this, the fact that there is not universal condemnation of the tweet, the posting of this tweet by members of his own party who can go and say, I love his other policies, I love X and Y, and the fact there's not universal condemnation of this credible report about his good friend Vladimir Putin putting bounty on the lives of American soldiers, it shows that divide is nowhere near being healed, whether he's defeated in November or not, Irene Munro.
Yeah, but you know what? I think what's really interesting, I think clearly Trump has picked his side. And I think it's not about putting up the tweet. It's the thinking of putting it, I mean, taking down the tweet is the thinking of putting it up there. And what I think that we have to understand when we talk about fascism or just cruel leaders, it's not just he's the symbol of it, but we got to understand the people who support it.
Absolutely
so,
right.
So we got to look at Mitch McConnell. We got to look at the people who are complicit in his behavior, in this type of behavior. He serves a certain purpose. And while they understand that he is a wild card, they can look beside that, because when we look at these evangelicals, I mean, you question, well, what Bible are they reading? Are they reading the same Bible? But one of the things that we've seen that with pro-Trump evangelicals, they typically attack anti-Trump evangelicals evangelicals in certain ways. They will label them as left leaning, that they're pro-choice. Nothing, and it's so far from the truth. So my point is that this is a battle in which the courage of the folks who are in power have to decide what kind of nation this is going to be come the day after election.
You know, when you said one of the lines that is stuck in my head, you know, and I don't know why this one more than any other. When you mentioned the Bible there, Irene, I assume all three of you heard the question when the photo op was done at St. John's across from the White House, and he held up the Bible, of course, without reading from it. He held up a Bible. A woman reporter yelled out, "Is that your Bible?" And he paused for a split second, and he said, "It's a Bible." It's a Bible, is what he...
At least he didn't claim it was his.
So, okay. Emmett...
Was blasphemy in real time.
I would say so. Emmett, what's your takeaway on this this retweeting from Donald Trump?
Well, I agree with Irene that this is about the people. This is about we the people, and will we rise up and become we the people, or are we going to further entrench ourselves in enclaves in terms of supporting, you know, demagogues and idols and platforms and positions? This has nothing to do with Democrat, Republican. This really has nothing to do, to be honest with you, about Donald Trump, other than the fact that he's a catalyst for these conversations. This is really about we as the people. What are we going to stand for? Who are we going to become? And what are we going to say about ourselves in real time? I think that's what this is really about.
Yeah, and it also suggests this, that if we don't come together, we have really failed at this experiment of democracy, that it's multicultural and it's participatory of all people.
On that note, good to speak to you
both. Thank you so much, both of you. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. The Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price join us every week for All Revved Up. Reverend Irene Monroe is a syndicated religion columnist, the Boston voice for Detours, African-American Heritage Trail, and a visiting researcher in the Religion and Conflict Transformation Program at BU School of Theology. Emmett Price III is a professor and executive director of the Institute for the Study of the Black Christian Experience at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. They are the hosts of the All Revved Up podcast. To learn more about it, go to allrevvedup.org. Coming up, just as Reddit, you read this, Jim? Reddit just banned the Donald, one of its most biggest platforms, because of its racist and anti-Semitic stuff.
No, I had not.
Put more pressure on, yeah. Going to put more pressure on Facebook and other social media sites. Anyway, we're going to talk about what we just talked about with Emmett and Irene. The president, is he empowering white power? That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH. Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. As the nation grapples with racism, President Trump appears to grapple with white supremacism. As we said yesterday, he retweeted, then deleted a video in which one of the supporters shouts, "White power. White power." The video shows residents of a Florida seniors community, I guess, known as the Villages, driving in golf carts decked out with signs that say Trump 2020, America First. It was this video that Trump chose to share with his 82 million Twitter followers, along with his words, which were, "Thank you to the great people of the Villages." If Trump thinks someone who chants white power is great, what does it say? And we're taking your calls asking you, if you're refusing to wear a face mask is putting people at risk, how dangerous is supporting blatant racism? What happens when the power of the White House meets up with white power? Or are you buying the explanation of his people, his press people, that he had no idea? He was just trying to show his support for what his press person, Kelly McEnany, said was demonized supporters, that he had no idea the white power line was in there. 877-301-8970. About once a week, I say to you, Marjorie,
yep,
this is so disgusting that I cannot believe it. And it's sort of like some of the other things are not. And I don't know why some strike me more than others. this is right. Does anybody really believe that he retweeted a video that, considering he's on Twitter and watching television essentially all day, every day, that he had no idea that this white power thing was in there? It's so obvious, as I said to the Revs, is he decided to get the benefit of both things, is to have it up there to show his support for the racists who support him, and then pull it down and, you know, no harm, no foul kind of thing. I think that the notion that a president of the United States in the middle of what we ever, but in the middle of what we're going through at this moment, has the audacity to retweet this thing and then have his spokespeople say, hey, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know that the central theme of the video was the central theme of the video, is so appalling to me. I can't even, whatever. I mean, it's unbelievable. Again, I mean, we have so normalized this aberrant racist behavior in this country. It is this is not some schmo state rep from Indiana. This is the president of the United States retweeting a white power video.
Again, I'm always amazed that you're surprised by this.
I know.
He has demonstrated, you know, as we all know, he was elected, you know, shouting this birther thing about Barack Obama that he only admitted grudgingly because he was forced to. He never conceded that. As everybody knows, he ran these ads, full-page ads in the New York Times and other media outlets in New York to basically execute the Central Park Five killers and the rapists, rather, and they weren't rapists at all. It was a disastrous botched case, and even after they were deemed to have been caught up in this botched case, he wouldn't admit it. I mean, he's been giving these rallies, no mention of systemic racism, no mention of police brutality, no mention of any of this stuff, but he did spend 15 minutes explaining at that rally that nobody showed up at, the 6,000 people as opposed to a million people, that, you know, that why he was slipping as he walked down the rampway at West Point because he had slippery leather shoes on or something. So, I mean, I think, you know, we saw John Bolton everywhere these last few weeks, and I'm no fan of John Bolton, but when you hear John Bolton talk about the dangerousness of Donald Trump and the dangerousness of a totally unleashed Donald Trump in the next term when he has nothing to worry about in terms of reelection, it's really frightening. I mean, he's unhinged and deranged, and I don't think there's any question about his racism at this stage of the game, is there?
I think this speaks for itself. 877-301-8970. What's your reaction to this? Marjorie thinks she, I guess, weekly is incredulous that I'm incredulous about the behavior of the president of the United States. What's your reaction?
Well, it's the Maya Angelou line. You know, when people show you who they are, believe them. He's been showing us for 40 years who he is, or 50 years.
Well, I don't want to say Maya Angelou was outdone, but I've quoted the former Democratic candidate for governor only about 3,000 times in Florida when he was asked at a debate. I did this as recently as last week here. Do you think Donald Trump's a racist? He says, I don't know, but I know that racists think he's a racist, which is one of the cleverest lines.
That was a great line. Was that Andrew Gillum? Was that Andrew Gillum? Is that that? That was a great line. Yeah, okay. 617, oops, that's not the number. 877-301-8970 is the number. That's right. Yeah, that's right. 877-301-8970. The email is bpr@wgbh.org. Let's start with Maddie in Watertown. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Maddie.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good.
So I watched the video. Did you watch the whole video? I think you did, Marjorie.
Yes. Yep. Yes.
I mean, you couldn't miss it, but to me it was remarkable because it was a bunch of senior citizens yelling at each other and the lady like grab him by the, and then they almost run her over. And I'm just like, what kind of village is this? I mean, I have friends that live in Florida, but I never saw anything like, I mean, we went to yard sales with my friend's mother in her 80s and, you know, those huge outdoor events. And I never I don't know. Yeah, he couldn't have missed it.
You know, the other great story about the villages, which some people have disputed since, that there were rampant STDs down there, that the senior citizens were wild in the streets down there at the villages. But other people have disputed that and said it was an urban legend and overblown. I don't know what the truth is.
I'm glad you spread it then based on the fact that we don't know if it's true.
Well, I think the jury's out. The jury's out on what's really going on in the villages.
The STD issue.
Jim.
Maddie, yeah. Thank you for the. You know, by the way, Maddie, you should watch a video. If you think that mm-hmm. there's some hyperbole here, go watch the video. First of all, it is strange to begin with, as Maddie suggests. And I think one of the anti-Trump people is yelling racist at the yeah. Trump people, which, again, I'm sort of a believer in civility. But I would argue that yelling that someone is a racist is not even in the same ballpark as white power being chanted twice by this older man in a golf course. That is what makes it so weird. You're right. Was that the point you just made or Maddie just made? The whole weirdness of the whole thing is it isn't is some tense standoff, you know, in some urban setting in America.
Is this what we have to look forward to, Jim? Riding around a golf cart screaming about the bingo games? You know, is this where we're headed? I don't know. And people are just really fit to be tied. I mean, there was a woman who held this banner that said Trump a racist and a bigot or something, and she's doing battle with the people coming by telling her to drop dead. I mean, it was really nice. Something. A lot of people have a lot of energy, I'll say that.
By the way, I have my application in there. I'm on the waiting list, and I'm...
For the STDs or for the
come along with it from what you say.
Mark in Dorchester, thank you for calling. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Jim. Long time listener, first time caller.
Thank you.
Great.
I just want to say, you know, that I try to keep as level of head as I possibly can. But today, this morning, I finally lost it with my best friend. of 45 years over Trump, and she was trying to defend him, and I just really fell apart.
Around this or around something else there? Wait, around this or what?
It was just over. It was over this, and it was over her comment that. CBS, NBC, ABC were wrong, and Fox News is correct. And just, you know, the typical party line. And, you know, I've tried very, very hard, including with some Trump supporting family members in the South. I've tried very hard to just kind of keep the politics out of it to preserve the peace. But, you know, I'm just, this latest thing has just pushed me completely over the edge.
By the way, can you really hear it in your voice, by the way, Mark? I mean, you really can really hear it in your voice. And it's sort of how I feel. I mean, when Marjorie is saying, Jim, I can't believe you don't get it, that's how I sort of felt about this latest installment of Trumpism where you are, Mark. I just couldn't believe it. So,
yeah, Mark, but... Michael Moore had it correct from the very beginning.
What did he say?
We know it's going to be. He said, you know, we know it's going to be bad, but we have absolutely no concept of really how bad it's going to be.
Well, that's an uplifting word. Mark, thank you for the call. You know, I can't believe, by the way, speaking, Mark just mentioned Fox News. Did you read the article I sent you? I thought you were going to be dancing all over the Cape over the weekend.
Chris
Wallace? A study was done which concluded. This is not opinion, that viewers of Fox News were put at greater risk for COVID-19 because of what they heard on the station than non-viewers of Fox News. Not just your opinion or one's opinion. When they viewed and believed the crap that they saw there about it being exaggerated, there was a hoax, etc., they didn't take as much care and they suffered as a result. It's pretty dramatic. Finding.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not surprised. I think that they lie with great regularity to people, and it's really kind of horrible, especially when you think about this and that people are putting their lives at risk. Fran from Newport, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, Fran.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Listen, this comes from a long line of Republicans. Just remember Willie Horton. I mean, that's what we have going on here, and you know, stuff works. You know?
By the way, Fran, I hate to disabuse you. Willie Horton, the conventional wisdom is this was a Bush-inspired thing. Do you know who actually first brought up Willie Horton?
I'm not sure.
Al Gore.
It was Al Gore.
Al Gore. It was elevated to an art form, a horrible art form by Bush against Dukakis, but it was originally in the primary brought up by candidate Al Gore. So,
but you know, the Republicans are great at this kind of thing. It's scary. You know, I mean, it's not just him; it's Republicans. Republicans. So get out there and vote for Joe. You know, get people to register to vote everywhere.
Fran,
you know?
Thank you. We got it. Thank you for your call.
Whoops. Whoops.
Oh, I'm sorry.
877-301-8970 is the number. BPR. Oh, we are? Oops. Yeah. I wasn't paying close enough attention to the time.
Shocking.
Okay. Yeah, we're running. Oh, we are running out of time. Thank you, Jim, for pointing that out to me.
So just so we're clear, before we leave. No, we don't. But let me just be clear about this. So you're not, you're not suggesting to me, I want to be comfortable here, that this is not horrible. You're just saying, why are you shocked by its horribleness? Is that what your basic point is to me?
I guess at this point we've seen enough to make a judgment. I mean, as John Bolton, character matters, and he has none. And that's a problem, I
think. But the president tweeting a white power video.
It's horrible, but I'm not surprised. I mean, not only does he lie, but the people around him lie. Get up there and bolt. I mean, the sky is not blue, it's purple.
Yeah.
And they say it with a straight face. It's really incredible. I mean, just we heard Kellyanne Conway, who was outraged about the Kung Flu remarks from a few weeks ago, mentioning that her children are part Filipino. And then she says, he didn't say it. I mean, we all saw him say it. It's like another world that they've created. And I think it's unfortunate that people are gullible enough to buy into it. But apparently millions of us are. Anyway, we are done with this. We're coming. we're talking to our TV guy, Bob Thompson, which is absolutely wonderful. A little relief from all this. He's going to be up to tell us about a lot of great stuff you can watch on TV, and maybe one not so great thing that we were all hoping was going to be great, and he kind of bursted that balloon. Our TV expert, Bob Thompson, is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan as host of The Daily Show. Jon Stewart turned his nightly political commentary into an art form. But can Stewart deliver the same caliber of comedy when he's not responding to real-time politics, but satirizing entrenched political systems instead? Bob Thompson joins us online for his take on Stewart's new film, the political comedy Irresistible, among other TV news. He's the founding director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture. That's Bob, not Jon Stewart. And a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Hi there, Bob.
Hi, you two. How are you?
We're good.
Hello. Hello. We're very good. So what's your worst?
Well, it hurts me to give Jon Stewart's Irresistible, which is the 26th, my worst. And this isn't by any means a terrible film.
Oh, yes,
it's
it is.
It's just that this is Jon Stewart. It's a political comedy. We expect it to be something much more than it was. And, by the way, if you wanted to watch this, you either had to find a theater that was open and playing it, or you could see it on all kinds of different places, Amazon Prime, Apple Plus, Google Play, DirecTV. But it was $19.99, which is a pretty steep price tag.
Well, let me just say, I watched it yesterday, and let's play a little sound first. This is actually not from the body of the film, but as the credits are rolling to Irresistible, Jon Stewart asked Trevor Potter, who's the former chair, I think, of the FEC, about the role of money in politics. Here's just the taste.
The money continues to pour in and corrupt not just where they spend their time and how they spend their time, but on the types of legislation that they would even bring to the fore. And the one group that would be charged with regulating this spigot doesn't meet because there aren't enough of them.
Yes. I realize that's not helpful to you, but...
It is very helpful. Thank you.
That may have been the best part of the film. Let me tell you said it wasn't terrible. I thought it was so sophomoric and And by the way, let me be very clear here. I thought Chris Cooper, who's a local guy who we love, was great. I thought Rose Byrne,
she's always great,
even though she's in it for about 30 seconds, is great. I thought Steve Carell was atrocious. And I thought
he was?
I thought he was. And I thought the whole plot was so childish and simple-minded. And so, I mean, one of Stewart's great things, I thought, John, was how I'm Jonathan Stewart. I'm so upset about this thing. Was how, you know, sort of, I don't know, subtle, but so how sophisticated his thinking was. And I just thought this was so simple. I thought it was also demeaning to virtually everybody, including people he didn't mean to demean. I, you know, it's one of those things, and I'll show up after this.
Who did you mean, Jim?
Well, particularly Midwesterners. Treats them like morons. I mean, total morons, you know, like rural types. But, you know, I've said this to you, Bob, in the past about other things that I thought should have been great that were horrible, is it's amazing to me when you finish a work like this that you don't step back and the John Stewarts of the world don't say, you know, this really doesn't live up to who I am and my abilities. Do you know what I mean? I mean, how could just whatever? I think it's hard.
Well, I'm not sure he. Okay, for a bunch of things. First of all, right. Even though he tries to kind of, in some ways, ennoble this Wisconsin town shot in Georgia, by the way. You're right. They're little digs. For example, this character who's supposed to be the noble character goes to the bathroom and doesn't wash his hands after he comes out, which I suppose is even more jarring after this thing has been made. But there are little bits like that. But the other thing I fault it for is it's just not very funny. You can
that's a great point. I forgot
stretches
that.
Of this. And not get a single laugh out of it. Now, for those of you who heard that clip, shouldn't mistake that Jon Stewart is in this. He's not. He's not even in that clip. At the very end, though, like Aesop or some other fabulist, he felt the need to put a moral at the end of the story. So after a little bit of the credits play, we just see the shot of that former election guy and Jon Stewart's voice, kind of giving us, in case we didn't get it, here's what this movie was
exactly.
all about.
That's a great point. In case you didn't get it, yeah. So, Marjorie.
Okay, well, I guess you've saved your $120 between the two of you. I think that's
in any case.
That's cool. Let's be more uplifting here. What's your best?
I'm sorry, I'm going to give it to American Masters again. I know I'm sounding once again like a broken record, but
it's the Toni Morrison.
That's okay.
Yeah, Toni Morrison, The Pieces I Am. 2 straight hours, a good chunk of it, Toni Morrison from various interviews that she's done. And I have no problem spending 2 hours listening to Toni Morrison. This was finished just a little bit before she died, so it takes the story just about to the end.
Do you have a clip sheet there, Marjorie?
Yes, we do have a clip sheet right here. Let's hear Oprah Winfrey talking about Toni Morrison in American Masters, we were just speaking about with Bob.
One of the characters says at the end of Song of Solomon, and she was loved. And she was loved. That is the anthem for any life. You can come to the planet and do whatever you do, accomplish whatever you accomplish, awards, degrees, no degrees, successes, no successes. I think she captured the essence of what it means to be human, to be alive, and to have done well here on Earth. And we can say the same thing for her. And she is loved.
Was that a beautiful sound?
Oh, my God. I love Oprah. Oh. I mean, she just does it over and over again. But anyway, we're not talking about Oprah. We're talking about Toni Morrison.
Right. And that's the great thing about this show was that Oprah, including that poetic elegy that we just heard, Oprah is by no means the best part of this show. It's Toni Morrison herself, who, and I learned a lot of things I didn't know. She makes a really good carrot cake. She can get people to do stuff with her carrot cake. She starred when she was at Howard as Queen Elizabeth in Richard III, and apparently really delivered. And something else I was very pleased to hear, she started her career as an editor here in Syracuse, New York. She came here for 2 years to work at a place that was a kind of a textbook operation that was then bought out by Random House. Random House brought her to New York, and the rest is history.
Well, you left out, I would argue, one of the most important things, John Stewart is on my mind, Bob, if I may. is the Toni Morrison thing cost $19.99 less than Irresistible. That's I can't. I just, okay. I'm sorry. Okay.
So Gone with the Wind appears to be back after
it
being gone. What is going on with the movie from the 30s, Gone with the Wind?
I think HBO Max did a wonderful job of fixing this. They brought it back, and if you put in Gone with the Wind in the search, it'll bring up the movie, and it'll bring up a little documentary. When it brings up the movie, there's a nice, it's very short, but probably that was needed to get people to actually watch it, by Jacqueline Stewart, University of Chicago Film Studies person, who puts it very quickly into perspective, and then the movie plays. The other square that comes up is a documentary, an hour long, a discussion essentially, made by Turner Classic Movies when they had a film festival with it featured. And that's got Molly Haskell, who's written for many, many years on women's issues in movies, Jacqueline Stewart again, Stephanie Elaine, a producer, and hosted by Donald Bogle, who's a scholar of TV and film, especially African-American TV and film. And that hour long is really, really worth watching. If we could do this to all the old movies and TV shows with problematic content, it would be a wonderful course.
Well, you know, though, I was a little upset by the fact that you can skip this four-minute, whatever it is, intro segment. Like, you skip ads. So I wonder how effective it's going to be. How many people are going to sit through that?
You know? Well, I didn't know that. I didn't know you could skip it. When I pushed Gone with the Wind, she came up and started doing the introduction. But I suppose I wasn't trying to skip it because I wasn't going to watch the movie. I just wanted to watch the introduction.
This is what The Verge says. They could be incorrect, but they say you can skip this four-minute introduction, and then this hour-long panel discussion is a separate thing that you need to watch separately. But I get that.
That does take some of the teeth out of it, doesn't it?
Well, but you can skip anything. You can skip part of anything that's on video. What on video that you're watching or on demand can
something
you not
that
skip?
Doesn't say skip
on Hulu if that's, you don't pay for non-commercials. Yeah.
You know, can I say one other thing? That whenever we talk about that, I think we did this when we discussed the problem with Gone with the Wind a couple of weeks ago with you. The first movie that always comes to mind that is wildly popular that's got real problems is Dumbo. And I'm reading a story, maybe the same piece. And Disney Plus also puts a caution, and it says the word may contain outdated cultural depictions. May? I mean, to me, that's worse than saying nothing. I mean, it is ridiculous. I mean, if you're going to do it, do it. And I think they sort of
did. What's Tom
that?
And Jerry, they do something too.
Same deal?
Yeah. This says explicit warnings, a cartoon with no May, quote, depict some of the ethnic and racial prejudices that were commonplace in American society.
Well, that's how it should be. I mean, it's
yeah. Tom and Jerry is also dangerous. I nearly killed my brother once by imitating an act that I saw on Tom and Jerry. No kidding.
We're talking about Bob
Thompson. So the thinking is, and it makes sense, you don't want to totally censor American films or American history, but you want to have the appropriate caveats.
Or American art. I mean, we've
That's
discussed
idea,
this in lots
right?
of contexts. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So tell us about Disclosure.
Disclosure, network documentary film, just a one-time film, debuted this Friday, so fresh off the Netflix constantly more material. It was not this past Friday. It was Friday the 19th. So it's a week and a few days old. Really, really good. It's a documentary film about Hollywood's depiction of trans people, and that includes all kinds of Hollywood depictions of mostly men dressed as women, but sometimes the other way around. Among the executive producers of this is from Orange is the New Black, made the cover of Time magazine, Laverne Cox, and she's in this a lot. And I did not realize how many images of making fun of people dressed as women and making fun of trans people go back way down to the silent era. Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, a Jim Carrey movie I thought was hilarious when I watched it, has got some really, really, really problematic stuff in it. Anyway, not a really long movie, less than 2 hours long, but filled with information.
Here's a little sound from the documentary Disclosure, and this is actor Laverne Cox talking about what it meant for her to see trans people as the butt of the joke on so many TV shows like The Jeffersons.
You know, I went to church every Sunday and was a straight-A student, and I won talent shows with the tap and jazz dance numbers I choreographed myself. So that was like who I was, and my mom wanted me to be successful, and I was being groomed to be successful, and then I turn on the television and I see these images that don't seem to comport with like the person that I knew I was. And so everything that was trans about me, it made me just hate.
You know, a couple things. I had her on last year on Greater Boston during an anti-trans initiative here, and she was so effective as an advocate. It was incredible. But a couple of things I learned from reading. I haven't seen Disclosure yet, but I've read about it. Apparently, there's a survey poll that says 84% of Americans say they don't know somebody is trans, and the writer of this piece makes the point. So we are much more dependent upon media to form our opinions about people whom we don't know, which makes these negative stereotypes even more dangerous than they were. So I'm really glad they did this, and I'm dying to see it.
That's right. Many people, the only trans people they know are those they saw on TV.
Sure.
That Jeffersons episode was actually, and it had the typical burlesque kind of approach, but that was a show that was very much attempting to be a positive presentation of a trans person.
Oh,
so
really?
I'm not sure if, anyway, but that's who knows how people read it. There's also moments in that documentary that I thought was interesting. One guy almost broke into tears talking about when he saw an episode of Jerry Springer dealing with trans characters, and he said he found it so empowering. Yes, it was Jerry Springer, and it was all a crazy circus that they do, but the very fact that he saw representations there, he found very empowering. So I think different people, depending on where they are in their lives, see these depictions sometimes in very, very different ways.
So we're talking up to Bob Thompson, our TV critic. Netflix appears to be swarming or saturating the airwaves. What's going on?
Yeah, this is July. Things have been out of production for the longest time, and this July, Netflix is putting almost 59 brand new things. This is original content. Forget the all the new licensed movies and everything that they've got. That is so far past Disney Plus or new HBO Max or Hulu or Prime or Apple TV or any of them, and it keeps they just keep plugging away. Of course, because they drop things all at once, they've got to have stuff done ahead of time, which is why they've got a lot of this stuff. But their inventory never seems to stop.
You know, one thing I don't understand that I'm sure your answer is going to prove that I am a dope for not realizing this. There was a piece I read that said while there's roughly almost 60 new projects coming online there in July, they're dumping or ending the runs of 60 other major things. Why do they end runs? What's the thinking behind that?
Okay, they cancel production, but they end things that they've got license deals with. So they only paid the license deal for a certain period. And a lot of those are movies. You're right. There's 59 new things, series, whatever's original, but they're always cycling out. So you better watch your Solo, A Star Wars Story soon, or Sex in the City 2, in case you missed that one. That's leaving. The three Back to the Futures will be gone in July. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. But anyway, that's all licensed stuff that they have the license for a while, and then those places renegotiate. For example, Friends in the Office were great favorites on Netflix, and those got picked up by other places.
So what are we watching, Bob, this week?
This one's easy. July 3rd, Disney Plus.
Can't
Hamilton.
Wait.
For all those people who wanted to see it. And this isn't just some goofy movie adaptation. This was shot with the original cast, Richard Rodgers Theater, in 2016, over 3 days, two live performances and one performance without an audience. So So it's back when Hamilton was really at its peak. This wasn't supposed to debut for about another year and a half, but they pushed it forward based on the virus and all of that kind of, and the George Floyd stuff. So July 3rd, Hamilton, find somebody who gets it to Disney Plus.
Did you see it, Bob, on stage?
I never did, I'm sorry to say.
You know, it's one of these things where, can we say how we got tickets? We can. I think it's fine, right, Marjorie? Yeah. Steve Kerrigan, who's a friend of ours, who's a guest, ran for lieutenant governor, had a, when he worked for Barack Obama, his intern, or one of his interns, turned out, played George Washington in the Massachusetts production.
He's had a lot of impressive interns.
And he got, right. You know who another intern, we should say Pete Buttigieg was another intern
Pete
of his.
Buttigieg.
Steve's had a pretty good run of interns.
Yeah.
I think that was when he was with Ted Kennedy, actually. But in any case,
Buttigieg,
he got
tried to play George Washington once, too, but that didn't work out for him.
But he got his tickets for like $200, which sounds like a lot, and it is, but it's nothing next to whatever. But, you know, when you see this, and I am so excited about this, I can't see straight, by the way. To see it, you know, the play shot as opposed to like a perform, you know, it is the play, is when you go there, and I think Marjorie had this same experience, Bob, and I think people will with TV, when you hear rave reviews about something where every single person says this is the greatest thing I've ever seen, you're sitting there worrying for the first 5 minutes.
Exactly.
What if
it's
I'm disappointed?
Yeah.
And after about literally 2 minutes, you explode in a way that is just, it is indescribable.
It's
how great
the
this
best
thing is.
Thing I've ever seen.
Me too.
Not that I've seen everything on Broadway, but I did see the Book of Mormon, which is good. But this is a million times better.
Great.
And it's so versatile. You know, it goes from the rap songs to these like kind of, you know, love songs of despair. I mean, the range of this guy's talent is just
brilliant. Just
incredible. Yeah, and everybody in the cast is so good. And you can also hear the lyrics, which I think is unusual too. Do you notice that, how well you can hear everything what people say? Anyway, I thought that was great.
It's amazing that a Broadway show, you can actually hear the lyrics, I'll tell you. It's really...
Well, so lots Bob, of times you can't.
So, Bob, you're usually giving us advice. Trust us, but you are going to love this like you cannot imagine. Actually, maybe next week after you've seen it, we should get your review of one of the greatest.
Yeah, I can't wait because I'm also, apparently they had, you know, there's a few lyrics and things that they took out, I suspect because of language. So we'll see.
Oh.
I hope they don't do too much.
Oh, gosh.
I couldn't think of that.
Language.
That's amazing. But in any case, we're all going to be watching and we'll talk about it. Bob, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Hey, Bob, thank you too.
You excited about this before you...
Well, I'm probably going to tape it because it's July 3rd. It's Friday night, right?
Yeah, but you're allowed to watch it again, Marjorie. I mean, it just,
I'm allowed to watch it
again.
You
don't have to tape it. It's not a one-shot kind of thing. It appears on
Okay,
Disney
I can watch
Plus.
It over and over. Okay,
yeah,
thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I don't have Disney Plus. Do you have Disney Plus?
Well, I will.
Get Disney Plus?
I will.
Okay, Bob Thompson joins us every week. He's the founder and director of the Blyer Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Thanks again to Bob Thompson. We are done. Thank you very much for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow we're going to be joined by District Attorney Rachel Rollins, and I'm really excited about this. There's so much to ask her, but she's going to take your questions and calls as well. We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Mers, Arjun Singh, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubeli, Aidan Conley. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. Our offsite engineers are Miles Smith and Dave Goldstein. Jim Browdy, what's in the tube?
I'm going to be joined by the former chair of the New Hampshire Republican Party, who's the executive director of something called the Lincoln Project. She's been on a show.
Oh, great.
Jennifer Horn, and that's the bunch of very prominent Republicans who are leading the charge against Donald Trump. And I have to say, if you have not seen their ad around this whole issue of Putin paying to have our troops killed, it is one of the most powerful, toughest things I've ever seen. Then I'm going to be joined by the two people who won the Nobel Prize for Economics from MIT in 2019, talking about the economic slump here and around the world and the way out of it here and around the world. And then we've got a package on a UV machine being tested at Food Bank that could ultimately be used in supermarkets and other warehouses, that kind of thing. That's all tonight at 7 o'clock on Greater Boston.
That's going to be a good show.
I think it will.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Yep, you are Jim Browdy. Thank
That's
you
it.
So much for tuning in.
Bye.
Please tune in again tomorrow and have a great day.